welcome to Radio Free Nintendo, episode 239. I'm your host, Jonathan, anime hater Metz. And with me, as always, James, the anime whore Jones.
I'm pretty much vindicated just by the response your commentary got.
We've also got John Dynamic Lindemann.
The key word is dynamic, people.
No, it's not.
And Greg, the ever-patient Leahy.
No, hoy hoy, everyone. I'm a Bills fan, of course.
That's right. Yeah. He'll put up with damn near anything. We have a great show for you this week. Lots of fun games in new business. We might talk about a little bit of interesting dynamic news at the end of that segment.
Dynamite.
Dynamite news. I don't know about that, but after the break, we will have Retroactive. We're going to be talking about Legend of the Mystical Ninja. If you haven't played it yet, pause, play it, return. And yes, just to address the kerfuffle from last week, I do not actually hate anime, and I was sending a little personal joke to James, which is we do all the time, and it did not come across very well, let's put it that way. So, Greg, could you kick off new business for us, please?
I can. First of all, I wanted to mark an occasion. I realized this week that it's probably been very nearly exactly 20 years since I got my Super Famicom. I remember quite clearly that we got it right around my mother's birthday back in 1991. It was my mum's birthday this week. The original plan was to have it for my brother's birthday, which is 3 weeks earlier.
Somebody got stiffed!
It took quite a while to get all the money together and get all the everything sorted. It wasn't so easy as just, you know, ordering it online and having it show up at your door back then, especially importing stuff. But it still works 20 years later. I tested it today. It's a trooper. You got to give it that. It's seen some pretty severe punishment over the years.
It hasn't turned yellow, has it? That's just the American one.
It's got a bit discolored. It's not as severe. Like when you see the pictures of the American ones, I mean, that is yellow.
Oh, mine's horrible. I can't even look at mine.
Yeah, it looks really nasty. Whereas this, it's definitely, you know, if you see pictures of the Super Famicom, you know, its original promotional art or whatever, it's not that color. It's definitely had some of the same thing, but for whatever reason, it's just not as putrid looking. first of all, another thing, I finally got my hands on Okamiden. So this came out like nearly a month ago now. Is that right?
Yeah, although I haven't really heard a whole lot of people talking about it, at least in my circle or the people who I listen to.
Yeah, I mean, the wisdom of putting it out about a week before the 3DS.
Non-existent. It was
non-existent. Did get overshadowed a fair bit.
You mean Capcom's not taking good care of the Okami franchise?
Wow.
Well, at least they're releasing it. James, I cede the floor to you for your Miles Edgeworth 2 bitching.
I'm not going to bitch, but I'm going. I am upset that the Miles Edgeworth Investigations 2 game will not be localized.
It's all driven by sales, buddy. Sales. Okamiden selling out the ass.
Well, hold on. So not only did they not think that game is going to sell well, the flag they used as the marker for the original AAI sales was, quote, "Even Okami has sold better than that already."
Yeah, well, Okami, apparently Okamiden has sold better on DS than the first Edgeworth game did, which is interesting because it's completely opposite of Japan. The original Edgeworth and the second one have both opened first week sales over 100,000 copies.
Well, I mean, the game is total fan service for those Japanese fans. I mean, it wasn't even supposed to be an Edgeworth game. They put Edgeworth in because the fangirls demanded it.
Fangirls? Okay.
It was supposed to be about the investigator girl that you meet in the extra mission of the first Phoenix Wright game. And there was actual outcry over it, so they put Edgeworth in instead, and the game sold 100,000 copies in the first week.
You know, if I could guess as to why that game didn't meet their expectations, at least in the West, maybe it's because it's like the sixth or seventh game in the series released on the DS in a span of 5 years. There's a lot of those games, and they're all kind of the same.
This would be number six, yes. Although, yeah. I mean, it is different, at least.
Right. I mean, I thought it was the most interesting one they'd released in a while.
And 2 actually is considerably more different than the original. There's a lot more new stuff in there.
Oh.
But we'll never see it. At least not in this form.
What they've said, so, because what Christian Svensson, the community manager there, said was, first of all, he was a bit more categorical and people started crying.
Yeah.
And then he said, well, no, to be fair, we've just got no plans to do that at this time.
But then he noted that it was on this platform. It was like,
yeah,
wow.
And I thought it was interesting that Okami Dead, which kind of bombed in Japan, it certainly didn't sell 100,000 in its first week, no. That's for sure. But it's at least Capcom brought it over, but it's a bit overshadowed. There was some weirdness which ended up affecting me with the situation in Europe where, in the end, like a relatively small fraction of retailers actually stocked the game. So I had a pre-order in. I got charged for this pre-order on the day of its release, and then 3 weeks go by, so actually we didn't get any of the game in.
What?
Wow. Mission failed.
Wow.
See, Amazon won't charge your card until they ship it.
Well, no, in the terms and conditions of this retailer that will not be named because I'm merciful, they also are not supposed to do that. So, obviously, it was easy for me to say, well, you know, give me a refund. You shouldn't have taken the money in the first place. But it was just one of these things where I don't know whether they literally were expecting the copies in and they didn't get them. I don't know whether the shipments were sort of cut relatively at the last minute or what, but it was surprisingly not as available as it appeared to be in the end. But eventually, after refunds and getting it somewhere else, I have a copy and I have it for the price I originally paid for it. And I haven't been able to play it very much yet. I dabbled with trying it on the 3DS just to see the, you know, with the circle pad and how it kind of looked with the up-resing or whatever that makes it kind of look soft. The interesting thing about the softness is, first of all, there's quite a lot of pixely textures in this game because obviously it's got very much the same set of locations and the cutscene styles and everything as Okami, but just in a much lower res environment. So it's not necessarily the worst thing in the world to have some of those smoothed over, but it was funny how the difference between playing it on the DS Lite and playing it on the 3DS was really evocative of what Okami looks like on Wii. Because of that, it's weirdly soft, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't really know why.
Yeah, so anything that has hard edges, be it sprite-based games or in the Okami art style, is going to be really affected by the auto-blurring that the 3DS does in order to prevent it from looking too sharp. So the net effect is, instead of preserving the visual acuity of the game, they actually soften the image beyond what it should be.
So, I mean, the whole thing with the circle pad, obviously, no, it can't magically add analog functionality.
No.
But because it's got a nice feel to it, it does maybe feel a little better just cycling through those diagonals and the cardinal directions. But the DS Lite D-pad isn't bad for that because it's mushier. You know, I think the clickier D-pads that some of the DS models have had, that would be more of a problem. But the thing is, the way the game's camera works a lot of the time is it kind of, you know, there's quite a lot of auto cameras, you might imagine. Although, I guess, one of the reasons why they might have the action on the top screen, you know, so it has to switch for the celestial brush, is because there is a bit of camera control on the touchscreen. You've got the little icons. So you click on the side and it'll do a, you know, it'll rotate around a Chibi-Terasu.
Oh yeah, that's always a great idea.
Yeah, I don't know whether that's really worth the price that was paid or what the reasoning
is was.
Is
the lag bothering you? The screen switching lag that we've talked about?
I haven't played enough of it to really say definitively yet. I mean, it's not that bad, but, you know, I could imagine if you're doing a lot of maneuvers in a short space of time, it could get enough. We'll have to see how bad it is. I mean, the thing is with it, having played it just for like an hour and a half or 2 hours so far, much like the original Okami, it doesn't really start like a James Bond movie or anything.
The dam doesn't blow up in the first 5 minutes.
No, it does not. So it's very gentle. I mean, it looks very pretty. The music's pretty much just like, you know, a compressed version of the music from Okami. So it's very nice. And I guess we'll have to see how much of it is just downporting the Okami experience and how much is actually adding something new.
The really interesting thing is that if it does kind of downport the Okami experience to DS, that would still make it a more expansive console-like game than either of the Zelda DS games, which are more like the old 2D sort of top-down Zelda games in the way that they're presented. Whereas I've heard the interesting thing about Okami Den is that it really does kind of have this 3D world that you run around in that's actually more like a 3D Zelda game. And there's not really much like that on the DS.
I could say already, really. I mean, the locations here are the same locations. I mean, you recognize that they fit, you know, the Shinshu Field, the villages that I've seen so far. You know, you're like, oh yeah, I played Okami, what, nearly 3 years ago now, and and it's like, oh, I'm back. You know, but the concession that you see quickly is that even though you can kind of see, you know, the general kind of expanse there, there's a lot of popping with the details.
Right.
The draw distance isn't that great on quite a lot of the details. And second of all, they're partitioned. So you, like, even though you can see generally what's over in that direction of the field, to actually go there, there's like a specific little portal that you'll go through, and then it have a, you know, a modest kind of loading-ish transition, and then you'll actually be there. So it's a little awkward in that way. You know, you could tell that this is not an environment that was really designed for the DS. You'd probably handle it differently if you were designing it from the ground up for the DS, even though the game itself is designed from the ground up, but the locations that it's using aren't. So how that's going to kind of play out over the whole thing is interesting. But yeah, I mean, it's considering, you know, you haven't got analog control, you haven't got the greatest horsepower, it is undoubtedly ambitious to try and bring as much of the Okami experience over as it can. So we'll see how well it does next week, perhaps. But what I'm going to talk about now is an aptly named game called Last Resort, because I would only talk about Japanese virtual console shooter mops as a last resort, because typically when I raise these, it sounds like from the reactions of everyone else that I'm giving a eulogy or something, such as the level of hushed silence.
The trouble with Japanese shoot 'em ups, though, is that it's difficult to describe the differences between them in an interesting way.
Well, this one is not so much about the differences as it is about the similarities to a very specific game. So this Last Resort is a Neo Geo game from 92. There is a CD version of this, but it appears certainly that they've just put the cartridge version on. Well, I mean, I don't think there's very many differences between the two apart from, like, the music.
No load time.
No, with Neo Geo games, there really wasn't much difference because the cartridges were very high-capacity cartridges in the first place.
Yeah, so didn't they just put the ROM on a CD, and
yes,
then there was like a big load up front, and then that was it? It was,
yeah,
basically like playing.
Right, the advantage of the CD system was that the games were cheaper to manufacture,
much
but the
cheaper,
actual game content
imagine.
Really isn't different. So it's not like they have different Redbook music or something like they did with TurboGrafx.
No, well, I think in this case, because it was a few years later and stuff, I think it did have different music, but that was the only difference.
Okay.
But the music actually sounds pretty good in this, so I've got no complaints. But the thing about this is difficult to find out for sure, seemingly, but if you play this game at all, or if you look it up on YouTube, whatever, you're immediately going to think of R-Type. It looks a hell of a lot like R-Type.
The ship even looks like R-Type.
Well, the ship actually is a little bit longer and slimmer than the typical R-Type.
So completely different.
it's a weird type of shape for a shoot 'em up. It's kind of like,
it's very long.
It's controlling a torpedo.
And also avoiding copyright infringement.
Yes.
Barely. Very,
but,
barely.
Oh, it's. I mean, you look just like the fonts, the sound effects, some of the enemy designs, everything about this just screams R-Type. And the story that you hear is that this was made from inside SNK by people who had defected from Irem. But the big difference in gameplay terms, there is a meaningful difference, is that you have a very similar thing with the, you know, like the, what they call it, the force or whatever in R-Type, that shield that you
right,
can
yeah,
shoot off and put it on your front or your back or whatever. We have a very similar thing here, but there's a big difference in that it simultaneously operates both as that shield that you can have, but also as your charge shot. Because what happens is when you, in R-Type, you've just got a charge beam, but in this, you charge by actually firing it off from your ship. So it introduces an interesting little trade-off, because the charge shot is way more powerful. It can finish things off very quickly, even the bosses and stuff. But of course, because you're shooting off your shield to do that, then you're unprotected. And also, you can either lock it in place, or you can have it go free, so that if you
like
move
an option in Gradius.
Yeah, it's a bit like the options in Gradius, but more of a predictable orbit, because it really is very much a case of like, well, if I move up, it's going to be on the bottom of me, and it's going to shoot down as well, and so you can manipulate all these things quite reliably just with a D-pad control. You know, I mean, you could say, well, it would probably be better if you had dual analog and, like, you could just, like, flick the stick to fire it off and stuff. And that's probably true. But just for, you know, what would have been, of course, I suppose, the OG or the appropriate term of reference is the joystick, you know, like an arcade stick.
Yeah.
This kind of gameplay with this kind of nuance, it works surprisingly well.
There's a kind of option that does the same thing in Gradius 5. It fires in the last direction that you pushed.
Yeah, so it's similar to that kind of thing. But as I said, surprisingly, works really quite well, even with, you know, the sort of basic controls. And the level designs tend to kind of leverage all this kind of stuff. Like, you could go through certain sections a couple times and just think, God, this is ridiculously hard. But then you find that, you know, if you actually position the shield correctly, use the charge shot correctly, you can take out a bunch of stuff really quickly while, you know, maybe protecting yourself from other things, and then it becomes manageable, and then, you know, you could dodge well enough, and, you know, the way they sort of warp enemies in from all directions and all that, you've always got to be on your toes, keep moving it around. You know, it just feels dynamic.
Right.
And he's busy eating, so we didn't even get to hear him respond to it.
That's right. I am eating.
God damn it, John.
Dude,
yeah, I think the worst thing that can happen in shoot 'em up is just where, you know, you just feel like you're moving up and down and just shooting like a machine. You know, and it's just a monotonous kind of drone of a game. And you won't find that here. So it's pretty much like a cool R-Type sequel that actually makes some substantive changes while still feeling very R-Type, except it's not actually R-Type. But you still get, like, a giant battleship level, believe me. I mean, this is going to give... although the first level does have artwork seemingly ripped off straight from Akira. So,
nice.
You probably wouldn't have seen that in R-Type either.
looking at the official art for this game, besides looking oddly phallic, I can see where you're coming from on this one. It's inspired, let's put it that way.
And is Last Resort only available on the Japanese Virtual Console?
Currently, it was a very new release. It actually came out just a few weeks ago, the same month as Final Fantasy VI and all that. So, yeah, it's there have been some of these. I think was it Ironclad or was a Neo Geo shooter with, like, pre-rendered graphics, or latter day one that did actually make the jump from Japan to, I think, both North America and Europe.
Yes, Ironclad is available here.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's not out of the question that it could come over eventually, and if you're an R-Type fan and it does make the journey over one day, then I'd recommend looking into it, because I've quite enjoyed it. I like R-Type a lot, despite the fact that it's just ball-rippingly hard.
Yes.
This might actually be a little easier. I think inevitably, when you give yourself more gameplay freedom like this, they never quite, at least, you know, in the 90s, had the crazy graphics power to, like, create something that was equally overwhelming.
Okay, cool. John, you don't have anything you want to talk about this week, do you?
Not really. I mean, beyond Chrono Trigger. Basically, where I'm at now is I am fighting the Magus and basically getting my ass kicked.
Oh, dude, that battle, the music in that battle is my favorite video game song ever.
Yeah, so I rolled into the battle with Chrono, Frog, and Robo, and that's a horrible... I mean, that's a terrible... I mean, you have to use Frog and Chrono, but...
You're probably going to want more healing than Robo can provide.
Yeah, have you got Heal Beam yet?
I don't believe he has. I'll have to check. I didn't get too deep. I mean, I was too busy getting my ass kicked to really check too deep into their text, but...
Yeah, the thing is, he will learn a heal technique eventually, but I don't think it combos very much.
Yeah, the problem I was running into is that the boss was, he was doing kind of his rotating blocking, where he would block everything but Shadow or but Fire, and I didn't have any of those attacks, because I think Marl and Lucca, they're the ones that both have, like, fire sword.
Fire and ice.
Yeah, ice and that kind of stuff. And so I was just getting my ass kicked, and so I was just like, okay, I got to swap out.
You know, John, James can make fun of you, but the thing is, you are clearing out your backlog. I mean, you're playing the games that...
Well, hold on. We can't say he's clearing out his backlog until we have a definitive statement that he hasn't added games to it.
No, I have not added any games to the backlog.
Because that is an important point to make.
At all. I mean, Chrono Trigger, it has to get beaten. It has to. I'm tired of it. I'm tired of it being the running. I'm tired of it being the, you know, the running joke.
You realize that's quite a few endings. If we are of a mind to just string this out, we can do the kid. Well, yeah, you haven't done the lizard ending yet. So,
I can handle that.
That's a joke ending.
The fact that I've never even beat it has to stop. It's number one on my hall of shame. So
it has to stop.
It's going down.
There's a lot to be said for making progress on that. And honestly, I'm actually kind of getting a weird kick out of like hearing you tell the story of playing through it, because it's been a couple years at least since I played it.
At this rate, it could be like a radio serialization of Chrono Trigger. Like,
I'm trying to be supportive here.
maybe like 6 weeks from now, it's like, oh, I'm at the Black Omen. It's going to be exciting.
I appreciate it, Johnny. These other two assholes just ripped me apart, so whatever.
I'm sorry, John. Last time I played the game was 12 years ago.
I like the idea of a radio serialization of Chrono Trigger.
Well, you know, it's interesting, though, playing through it, because, you know, the one thing I don't like is... there's certain areas of the game where you get so deep that you get kind of worried, because you're like, I better save my game or else if something happens, I'm totally screwed. Fortunately, in most areas of the game, they have save points set up so you can save your game like before a big boss. But sometimes, you know, I'm get kind of like, you know, I've been playing for like, you know, about a half an hour and I haven't seen a save point, and it's just like battle after battle after battle.
Yeah, I can think of a very few sequences in Chrono Trigger where they force you to fight a series of battles, because for the most part, you can sort of go around enemies if you want to.
Yeah.
But there are certain places where they force you into combat, but I think it's pretty rare.
Yeah. Well, I guess the thing is you don't necessarily know where it's going to end. Like, you don't know how long they're going to force you to run that gauntlet.
You feel this anxiety of, am I going to make it through this or not?
Yep.
Overall, though, it's a pretty easy RPG, so
you
might feel like that, but you probably... I think, actually, the area right before Magus, and especially fighting Magus himself, is actually one of the hardest points in the entire game.
Yeah, it's pretty much that and Giga Gaia.
Yes, Giga Gaia, yes, on the floating island, the floating mountain.
The Mountain of Woe, what is it?
The great thing about the Magus battle, though, is walking into the room and it's completely pitch black.
Yep.
And as you walk upward, this line of fires light as you proceed upward. And the music in the background, you hear it. It's this whistling.
Yeah.
You hear the black wind.
Yeah.
That, oh.
Yeah, it's really cool, too. And his, you know, what he says before the battle, too. There's no, you know, a lot of the stuff in there is like, especially when you're going up to his fight, you're going against the Aussie guy. Who's, you know, kind of like the elf who's... It's really very, very tongue-in-cheek, like, you know, he's like, you know, kind of a dumbass, you know, but then you finally get to the boss, and he's just like, well, if you want to die, come get it, kind of thing. Like, he just says this huge epic thing, and it's like, you know, and you start fighting him. See, but I'm playing it on the DS. It has a little animated short of Frog walking through the dark. Like, instead of just going straight to the scene where it lights him up, where it lights up all the flames... It cuts away to like an animated short where it has like Frog walking through the dark, and then it cuts back to the game.
Mm-hmm. Very nice, sir. Okay, well, I'm going to go next. And first off, speaking of Chrono Trigger, I've been playing Radiant Historia because I finally got my copy. I ordered it like 3 weeks ago, so I assume that Atlas reprinted it.
Well, they did. They did a second print. Maybe they did a third.
Well, anyway, I'm glad I finally got it. I've been waiting a while, and you know, I think last week we demonstrated that there's a certain gulf between what James likes and what I like, and this game is an example of the overlap in what James likes and what I like.
I was worried where this was going.
No.
Because I wasn't gonna stand down on this one.
No, I knew going into Fragile Dreams there was a small chance that I would like it as much as you did. With Radiant Historia, because of the kind of game it is, I thought there was a very high chance, and I have not been disappointed at all. My game clock's up to, like, almost 9 hours, but I feel like I haven't actually played it that long, because it's on DS, so there's a lot of times where it ends up kind of sitting on my table as I eat dinner, or...
Yeah, you just set it down, and you're like, oh shit, left that on!
Right. At one point, I tried playing it while I watched a movie, and the problem was the game and the movie were both way too engaging to do anything else at the same time. So I ended up playing it for about an hour and got nothing done in the game at all. Because I was watching the movie, and then I would pause the movie and play the game and sit there for 30 minutes just playing the game. So I finally just had to put it down. I was like, I can't multitask with a game like this. It's not Picross.
And the game is quite willing to do things and let you waste as much time as you want.
Absolutely.
Because it makes no effort to compel you in the correct direction.
That's right, yeah. I mean, you really kind of have to... It's not hard to find what to do next, but sometimes I forget whatever the last scene was, and I'm not exactly sure where to go next. And That's fine. That kind of thing doesn't bother me. I mean, I read over your review again today, James, and a couple times you used the word nonlinear. And I was thinking about this, and I think for me, the way I see Radiant Historia is it's actually very linear. As most Japanese RPGs are. But the thing is, it's bilinear, because you have these two timelines, and they're both very straightforward, but the weird thing is you can move in both directions along them. Like, you can skip around, and then you can skip in between them also.
Right. I think it's got more to do with how I played it, because I spent a lot of time going way back to try to break up the timeline.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of little things you go back and do later after you reach a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it pretty much was nonlinear, because I spent about as much time in the first 20 minutes of the game as I did anywhere. Because that stupid section is the only way you can get to a lot of these events, which means you have to sit through the opening again or kill it quickly.
Well, I think the comparison to Chrono Trigger is most apt in the music, which is really, really good. And it's one of the only games I've played that actually does remind me of Chrono Trigger's music. It's just a style of music that I don't really find, you know, a lot of things imitating very well.
This reminds me, because this is Yoko Shimomura, and when we talked a few weeks ago about Xenoblade coming to Europe, we didn't mention the fact that she also did the Xenoblade soundtrack, but with also Mitsuda chipping in as well, who was the Chrono Trigger composer, or the principal composer of Chrono Trigger.
And she probably did that game first before she did this one.
Possibly, yeah, because it did come out nearly a year ago in Japan.
And there's a whole lot more music. So I actually went and looked at the soundtrack after that conversation for Xenoblade. It's four discs worth of music. So
wow.
Hello.
So yeah, they probably did that one first.
It's half the DVD.
But it sounds like, I mean, you got the Shimomura and Mitsuda. That sounds like it's going to be very, very enticing, a soundtrack.
But yeah, I mean, outside of the music, actually, the game that Radiant Historia reminds me the most of is actually Final Fantasy VI.
I can see that.
Because you have this sort of, actually, the first town that you start in Radiant Historia, I think has to be an intentional tribute to Narsh, which is the first town that you go to in FF6, because it has this kind of cold industrial feeling. You've got these big mech things, which I haven't seen them in action yet. You start in a mech in Final Fantasy VI.
Right.
But still, you see them, the town, you have these like steam engines that are just kind of sitting out next to buildings. It really evokes that, which is great.
Alistel, that's it. That's the name of the town.
Alistel, yeah. And it's not something I've seen very much of. So it's weird, because like, it's weird to play a game and it immediately reminds you of multiple instances of your favorite games ever.
It brings up a few different games that I'm playing, and not the same ones as you have, but it's like, wow, I feel like I've played parts of this game before and parts of it combined differently than I would have expected. Because if you've played a lot of strategy RPGs, the battle system can feel like other games. Because it's kind of a scaled-down strategy RPG game.
It hasn't quite hit for me that way yet. I mean, I like the battle system.
Right.
It looks kind of like the one from the Mega Man Battle Network games.
A little bit.
But I think it plays differently, but it looks similar with that grid.
With the grid view, combining skills to make yourself not suck.
Mm-hmm.
Where I think the Final Fantasy comparison holds is because it's kind of got the different... I think the word I used in the review was... stereotypical town formats. You know, there's the castle town, there's the machinist town, there's the jungle town. It feels a lot like the towns in that particular game, actually, and maybe a couple other Final Fantasy games.
You know, the way that the timelines are built on all these different events that you can go back to and try to understand the interactions between them, that reminds me a lot of Majora's Mask.
A little bit.
It would be difficult to keep up with it, except they give you this book that just keeps track of everything.
Yeah.
And it's really easy to go in there and look at it. And then in this game, it's actually a lot easier to kind of go back and investigate different events because you can just go straight to them. Whereas in Majora's Mask, you have a time limit and it resets, and it's a lot more laborious to try to set up a complex series of events.
And you're racing Anju to get to the point that he's at before time runs out, and you realize that fucker got there first.
Radiant Historia seems very forgiving in that while the structure of the game is complex, it really doesn't rush you to do anything.
Mm-mm.
And it gives you a lot of information about how everything's laid out. So it's really not very intimidating at all to look at the two timelines and figure out how everything is laid out.
There's only maybe two moments in the game where I'm looking at timelines and I know what I need to do, but I don't know how to do it. I'm like, I don't know what to do here. But ultimately, what it ended up happening was, in my expedition to figure out what to do, I had actually accomplished it already. I just hadn't gone back to the right time to see the result. So I spent like 3 hours hunting around for something I'd already done. Thanks, game.
It does seem like a big time sink. I mean, I really don't feel like I've accomplished very much in playing it for, let's say realistically, I played it for like 6 hours. And I guess I'm through a lot of the setup, but I feel like there's a ton of game left. I feel like I've really only scratched the surface.
Have you really gotten into the missions on the two parallel timelines now?
Yeah.
What happens is it kind of races. You'll end up racing along one timeline unless you really compel yourself to go to the other one. And then you just basically hit a dead end. And you're like, shit, I have to get over there now.
Yeah.
And then you'll race down that timeline. And then you'll find, well, maybe I can go back and see what's going on, what I missed between the two. Then towards the end of the game, they kind of really slow down. Once you start going back looking for things to do, progress just stops dead. And you'll lose hours and hours and hours trying to figure out how to get this stupid steel orb for this guy's arm so he can be stronger, even though you never use him in battle because he's worthless.
Well, I don't even know what you're talking about there, but
You'll figure it out pretty quickly if you're considering where you are.
The pacing of the game is interesting because James was joking earlier that sometimes it's not really clear what to do next, and you can make no progress if you want to. I mean,
yeah, you could just stick around and do nothing.
It doesn't push you forward a whole lot, which doesn't really bother me because I never feel like there's a lack of things for me to do. You know, one thing I do want to say though is that the game does start out pretty slowly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting. It starts out with an interesting sequence of events, but there's just a ton of text at the beginning.
Yeah,
and this can cripple a game, like in the case of, you know, the Golden Sun series. They're infamous for these two-hour intros where you're just blowing through worthless text to get to the game. In the case of Radiant Historia, it works out okay because the text is really good. It's just very solid writing, and the characters speak and interact to each other in a mature way. You know, I mean, they talk like grown-ups. They don't talk like little cartoon characters. There's not a lot of redundant or worthless emoticons and dot, dot, dots and stuff like that. I mean, they do pretty much get to the point. It's just that the story's complicated. There's a lot to say, but it doesn't feel like they're just chewing fat. You know what I mean?
They didn't feel like there was a need to basically say, these are two kingdoms, they're fighting the end. So they had to spend time discussing it because it does sort of impel the story. But ultimately, you have to set aside time to discuss it. It's somewhere you have to make the decision on where to do it. In their case, it feels like they made the decision to do it early. You just sort of get it out of the way, and then it's done, versus the slow bleed where it stopped. Okay, now we're going to explain how the war started. No, I don't care. I'm just trying to kill somebody. Just let me do it. Nope, time to talk.
James, one quick question for you. Am I ever going to find out why Marco looks like a child?
I think they just make jokes that he's just short.
So it's some kind of in-joke?
Yeah, I mean, he's not a child. He's just short.
Because the character designs in general are not super deformed. I mean,
they
look like people. They look like regular people. But there's this one character. He's a mercenary. I mean, he's a good fighter. But he looks like a little kid. And yeah. I'm like, why? Is he supposed to be a dwarf or...
His portrait looks like he's wearing, like, a bearskin rug over his body, so I don't know what the hell's going on.
Anyway, I do like it a lot. It's going to take me a while to play through it because it is a big game, and I just don't blow through games like you do.
Well, I would have marathoned it like that if I didn't have to, anyway.
Yeah. But it's very good. Very, very good. I'm very glad that I took your recommendation on this.
Did your copy come with the disc, or did they already stop putting the CD with it?
No, I didn't get a CD. I mean, you said it's kind of worthless, right?
It's five songs. I mean, they're really good. I mean, yeah. it's five of the main themes from the game converted to, I think, the two composers playing it on piano.
You know, I'm sure I could get that on the internet if I wanted to.
No, I was just curious if they stopped including it already.
I was just glad to get the game at all.
At some point.
And I paid normal retail price, which, At some point, that will no longer be possible.
Yeah, at some point, used copies of the game will cost significant money.
Moving on, I played another game, a much shorter game this week, called Puzzle Agent. It's a computer game. I got it through a Steam sale back over Christmas, and I just now got around to playing it. I think I paid $1 for it, effectively. I mean, it was one of those ridiculous packages. I think I got 5 games for $5. One of them was Reciteer, and another one was Puzzle Agent. Puzzle Agent is, even now, it's only $5. And I would say, for you guys, especially, if you're a Professor Layton fan, you really should check out this, because it's pretty much an American version of Professor Layton. It plays exactly the same way. You kind of move this character through different screens, you talk to people, you click around to find hidden pieces of gum that provide you hints, they're hint coins, and then you solve puzzles that are straight out of Professor Layton.
This is a Telltale title, right?
It is, yeah. The whole thing is like 3 hours long. So it's very bite-sized, but for $5, I think it's a fine value. And it's actually really good. It's very well made. The art style is really interesting, and the story is really interesting.
It is actually on WiiWare, by the way.
Puzzle Agent is not on WiiWare.
It's not out yet. Okay. But it is. They did announce it for WiiWare release.
Okay, so supposedly it's coming to WiiWare. Well, look out for it, because if the price is right, you should really consider getting it. It is Professor Layton in the snowy north of, I guess, Minnesota.
It looks like Fargo from all the images.
Yeah. It's like maybe North Dakota or Minnesota. It's in that region. The way they talk is very, very much Fargo. And the way the story's set up is very Twin Peaks, which is a funny coincidence, because Twin Peaks recently came out on Netflix Instant, and I've been catching up with it. And I'm not finished with the series, but I've watched a lot of it. And Puzzle Agent is, there's no question it was inspired by Twin Peaks, the whole style of it. Because you've got this guy who's investigating a mystery. There's a lot of curious people in the town who have all their little weird quirks. Some of them appear to be out of their minds. And then you hit the weird, mystical, inexplicable elements of the story, like little gnome dudes running around stealing things from you. And the funny thing about the story is that it ends abruptly without explaining most of what just happened.
Unimportant.
Which I think also is very Twin Peaks. It's like there's a lot of crazy stuff that's going to go on here. We'll explain some of it, but definitely not all of it. And you have to be okay with that. At some point, the game just ends, and you're like, wait, that's all?
What the hell?
And this FBI guy comes into your office, and he's like, not important, we solved the case.
Did Puzzle Agent get cancelled? Is that why?
It might.
You wonder if maybe it was, if maybe they cut off development before they
hey guys,
totally
time's up.
But then again, it could be totally intentional. I'm not sure. And there recently was an announcement there will be a sequel. I think it's coming out this fall, maybe. So maybe they'll take up those questions and return to them and try to answer them. I don't know.
It does look like it was pretty intentionally inspired by like a Twin Peaks Fargo hybrid. So yeah. I would guess the sudden ending is entirely intentional.
Probably so. It's a funny game. The puzzles are really good. The thing I like about the puzzles is that for the majority of them, I would say, it relies on the kind of puzzles that I like in Professor Layton, where there's some element that you're moving around, you know? So either you're trying to fit shapes into some kind of outline, or like a tangram, or there are tiles that you're rotating to make the pipes fit up. You know, there's stuff like that. There's a lot of interaction. There's not very much of look at this picture and enter a number based on the clues that we give you.
See, those are the ones I actually like, so.
Yeah, those can frustrate me sometimes because there's no indication really while you go through solving the puzzle that you're on the right track. Whereas when they're interactive, you can usually kind of get a feel for, oh, okay, I'm doing this right now. Which is not to say that it's an easy game. Some of the puzzles are very easy. Some of them are very hard. But for the most part, they take more advantage of the fact that you're playing this as a video game and not a book. with a picture. Mm-hmm. So I like that. I like the ones where you can kind of click on things and move them around and interact with them before you get the final solution. Anyway, it's very, very good. It's cheap. I do recommend it quite a bit. And the last thing I wanted to bring up really quickly is I played the demo version of Clash of Heroes HD, which just came out this week. And this is an HD remake of the DS game that Greg talked about a few months ago.
Yeah, Might and Magic, Clash of Heroes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Greg loved it. So I was pretty excited to play the demo, and I liked it a lot. It has this kind of, you know, puzzly gameplay, but it's set in this RPG setting, so it has a bit of puzzle quest to it. You know, you're gaining experience and you're buying items that help you out in combat, but the combat is essentially like a strategy puzzle game. I love the formula. My problem with the demo is that I found that it has these color-coded units. There's yellow, blue, and green. And I found that the blue and the green, oddly, were very hard to differentiate on the screen.
Not a problem.
It's bizarre. I certainly didn't have any problem on DS. I don't know whether it's some sort of bizarre side effect of having more graphical detail in the HD version that somehow made it less obvious, the contrast.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it is, because they obviously redid all the art completely for the HD version. And a lot of the units, like they have these units that are bears, they have these units that are deer, which are big elite units. And the problem is that because the sprites are a lot more detailed now, they've added things like on the bears, I think they're wearing belts and maybe armor, and they've got all these different details on them. All of those are not colored, they're just black. So they fill in whatever's left, you know, anywhere that there would be fur on this armored bear. That's the part that's blue or yellow or green, and it ends up being kind of a small part of the sprite. And on the deer, it's especially bad. And I actually posted about this on Gaff, and one of the developers apologized for it. He said that they had to replace the sprite for the deer unit very late in development, and they didn't have enough time to tweak it to make it easy to tell the color of it. So the problem on the deer is that the deer is white. Almost the entire unit is white, and the only parts that's colored is a little kind of tuft of fur on its chest and its antlers. And its antlers are, I mean, they're outlined in black, so there's almost nowhere for them to add color anyway. So using that, it's insane. I mean, I played this on my 38-inch HD TV on my PlayStation 3, and I can't tell blue from green. By the way, I'm not colorblind. There isn't even such a thing as blue-green colorblindness. And I did a test online just to make sure, and no, I'm not colorblind. It's just,
I'm glad you did a test.
It's really dodgy design. It's just bad art design. It's a shame because it affects the way you play the game.
I mean, the way the gameplay works, each turn you take, you're against the clock. You've got time to kind of look at it and puzzle out what you're going to do.
I'm approaching the screen, like, squinting my eyes, like, is that... Because you have to match up the same colored units. And I actually made moves that were invalid because I couldn't tell the damn color difference. I was like, I'm not buying this game if I can't tell the difference between the colors. That's ridiculous.
Well, you could buy it on DS. I could see it.
Well, I'm going to look into that because, I mean, it does seem like a great game. And it's nice to have it on the console. Nice to probably get it for cheaper than the DS version would be. But not if I can't play it. And the reviews haven't said anything about this. I mean, I know I'm not the only person, because I did see other people agreeing with me, but none of the reviews have mentioned it at all. And I wonder if maybe I need to tweak my TV settings or something.
The thing is, as well, is that the units do change, like, because you go through various phases of the story and sort of different characters that you play as. So there's like, a part later in the game where you're in the underworld and like all your units are like, you know, zombies and skeletons and stuff. And it might not be such a problem once you get past this particular set of characters with the bears and the deer and all, which it doesn't absolve it of anything, but it might not be that insurmountable a problem, but still ridiculous that it exists at all.
Yeah,
and I asked the developer if there's a colorblind mode, which is pretty common in puzzle games.
Yeah,
and he said there's not, and he said that they had a colorblind player beat the entire game, so they don't think it's an issue, but I do. Anyway, it's too bad because the game does seem really cool. You know, try it for yourself. If it doesn't cause you any problems, then maybe you should go ahead and buy it. For me, I was like, I'm waiting for a patch, or I'm going to look into the DS version.
Doesn't sound like you're getting a patch.
No, probably not.
I'm going to guess from that response, ain't no patch coming.
Yeah. Anyway, James, surprise us.
Not a lot to surprise on, actually. So I haven't had a lot of time to play much, so I quickly threw in one of the games that's been sitting on the backlog. So I'll probably talk about this game a lot more next week, but the game I grabbed was Phantom Brave, which is a spin-off of Because I'm a Fucking Masochist, Disgaea. It's supposed to be kind of easier, and then in some ways infinitely harder. So I'm pretty sure I've screwed myself over really badly. The primary difference that I've observed so far in all of the two missions I've beaten, one of which was a training mission with a single enemy who never attacked, is the main character herself is rather useless, and that all of her party members, instead of just being demons, are spirits that she has to put into things. So there's a bunch of just detritus lying around the battlefield, and she has to enchant that to put one of the spirits of her soldiers into it. The problem being that after a certain amount of time, depending on their level and the item, they vanish and they're done for the battle, even if they've not been defeated, and they're your best fighter. This has been an issue in my third mission, so that's kind of where I'm at right now. I'm trying to get my hands around the fact that they've created a system in which the game can arbitrarily, due to some sort of clock, decide, nope, you lose now.
So it's a strategy RPG, though, just like Disgaea?
Yeah, it's a strategy RPG with some kind of evil internal alarm clock.
Do they have penguins like Disgaea?
I haven't seen any yet. I'm sure they're in there at some point.
They gotta be in there.
Well, I mean, it's Nippon Ichi kind of uses them as their mascot now, so I'm sure they're in there somewhere. In fact, all the emails we get from Nippon Ichi America, at some point in the email, they're written like they're written by one of the printies at this point, which basically, which can be either amusing or really irritating, depending on if this email is important to you personally. If it's not for a system we cover, they're great. I enjoy reading them. If it's for us, I'm like, God damn, how am I supposed to handle this thing?
Well, before we close out new business, why don't we address a couple of bits of news here? You know, last week I kind of made fun of Nintendo of America for not having a release schedule for quarter two, and this week they corrected that, sort of, with a very lame release schedule for Q2 in America.
With fake dates. Thank you, Nintendo.
Fake dates, yeah. Apparently The Conduit 2 is already out.
That was my favorite. I was dying.
I don't know when it's coming out, but it's not out now.
I was like, yep. What is this?
Yeah, that was classic. I'm like, okay, so it's coming out on Tuesday. That's interesting.
It's coming out on yesterday. Perfect. So what's amusing is not only did we get the NOA one, we got the NOE one at the same time, like within an hour of each other.
Yeah, that's rare.
And yeah. And it also was full of fake dates that had already passed for games.
Oh, but that, yeah, that I'm used to that with it. The NOE ones tend to have. I did mention that last week that does tend to happen.
It's like, did they coordinate this bullshit?
Yeah, but Europe is looking a lot rosier for Q2 than America.
Yeah, well, specifically for DS, it's looking rosier. I would like to point out that the crux of the conversation last week was about Wii.
Right.
And in Europe, Nintendo is not publishing a single solitary thing for Wii in Q2.
Well, when is Xenoblade coming out? I thought that was
that
like...
Xenoblade, they confirmed again for this year, but it's not in Q2.
I think we always kind of assumed it was Q2.
I was kind of a bit disappointed, as I said last week. I thought there was a shot that could sneak in maybe towards the back end, but it isn't. And so what Nintendo does with the European dates is that they have a grid, and what they'll do is they'll helpfully bold their own titles.
Yes.
or at least titles that they're helping with, like with distribution, like Dead or Alive or Dimensions for 3DS, for example. So if you look at the Wii list, nothing is bolded.
Nope, nothing.
Nothing.
But you laugh, but this made my life a hell of a lot easier this week.
So in that, because surprisingly, because the one sort of revelation for Wii was the new Wii Play Motion, which has the Wii Remote Plus built in. But surprisingly, they aren't quite managing to get that out in Europe.
Nope. Too much to translate. Too much to translate.
So that's coming out in June in America.
But to be fair, Europe is getting some things that we're not getting, including the Solo Turbo, Greg Hastings Paintball 2.
Can't wait.
That's not Solo Turbo colon Greg Hastings.
No, but it's
those are separate games.
And the DSiWare Valet Parking 1989. Which...
Well, so with the...
Fuck me, I don't know what it is, but I want it.
Soul Robo is interesting. This is a Namco Bandai product that, again, Nintendo is going to do the distribution on and marketing and stuff. So we've talked about this before, and they just seem to be doing it more and more. They're sort of pitching in with the marketing side of things with third-party titles on their systems. But this is not something I really had heard of very much until I saw a video for it on the Japanese Nintendo channel through the Wii for this DS game when it came out a bit ago in Japan, and it's strikingly beautiful for a DS game.
Yeah.
It's a sort of action RPG involving mechs and anthropomorphic dogs and cats.
Yes.
So the fact that it is coming outside of Japan is quite shocking.
So when it was originally announced, I guess it was back in July of 2010. It was after E3. I remember seeing it going, we're never getting that game, and I want it really badly. Now I'm going to have to deal with the fact another region gets this game. We probably still won't.
The thing is, potentially bad news for James here, is that it is a DSi-enhanced game.
Yes, ooh, it is.
So I can't remember the specifics of what it does, but what that would mean is that James would be forced to put it back in Old Faithful, the old DS, rather than the glorious XL that he loves so much.
Yeah, the old gray lady.
He wouldn't be able to play it at all. If it's a Europe only, then he won't even be able to import it.
It's not a DSi exclusive, it's DSi enhanced.
Oh, it's optional.
But what it will mean is if you put it in a foreign DSi, it won't work at all. If you put it in a DS Lite or a DS Fat, you're fine. And that's the point. So James, if he did want to import, it would have to downgrade from the penthouse to the outhouse as far as DS is going.
So you guys get that awesomeness.
But just to reiterate about that a little bit. So it's a successor to a PS1 game called Tail Concerto.
Yep.
Aha. I've vaguely remember that game.
Which did come out in America, published by Atlus.
Yes.
So that's kind of the heritage there. I don't think it's like officially a sequel, but it's still anthropomorphic dogs and cats in mech. So
yeah.
It's
by the same thing. People.
Yes, it is. But it is gorgeous.
It does look
if
really
you see,
amazing.
Look it up on YouTube, whatever, is one of the most beautiful things you will see on DS, no doubt.
Solato Robo. All
yeah, so that actually came out like the day before the big release list of games hit, and then that was on there afterwards. And that's
And it's 1st of July. It's actually outside of Q2 just.
Yeah, so they actually call it spring/summer, possibly because their spring lineup is the same games repeated 20 times for each country.
Yeah.
But you guys get two Nintendo-published DS games, although one of them is Dragon Quest VI.
Yeah, Dragon Quest VI is coming out on May 20th, which, you know, is good news because they've gone awful quiet on it, you know, and the American would have been out for a while and you hadn't heard anything, and I don't think 4 and 5 did very well commercially at all in Europe, so it's nice that it's coming out. It's not a huge surprise, but it certainly was conceivable that it wouldn't.
Yeah, I don't think NOA has any DS games, and Europe has two. NOA has one Wii game, or just two. NOE
it's
has
got,
none.
It's got the mystery case files, hidden
yes,
object your stuff.
Hidden,
yeah.
Your hidden item adventures.
Which is, I mean, it's not surprising, considering if you remember the one on DS, or the millionaire thing or whatever, that sold really quite well.
Yes, but there's now WiiWare things for 500 points that are also the same premise.
Yeah, and that's the thing. At the time when Mystery Case Files first came out, I think it was pre-DSiWare, they marketed it heavily to women. It was based on a series of novels that had been very popular with women, so it kind of made sense. On Wii, I don't think the concept works as... I mean, it's a find hidden objects in this picture game with a story. And I don't see how that makes sense on the Wii. And the other thing is, there's a lot of games like that on WiiWare and DSiWare. So, whatever. You know, I hope they make money on it, but it's not very interesting for us, certainly. Anyway, on a more positive note, the 3D... I haven't looked at the European list, but in America, the 3DS release schedule looks pretty solid for the next 3 months, actually. The only Nintendo game on the schedule right now is Zelda, which is coming out in June. Now, Star Fox recently got a date. I think that's in July for Japan.
Right.
Yeah, and just for Japan.
Just for Japan.
Right, but that's probably not long after in the rest of the world. But outside of Zelda, there's actually some kind of interesting-looking third-party stuff. You've got that Cartoon Network fighting game.
Punch Time Explosion, yes.
There's that Dream Trigger, the shoot 'em up that Aaron thought was pretty impressive, actually.
Yeah, that is not on the European schedule.
But yeah, there's a few pretty cool looking things. It's definitely not a desert.
Actually, May 24th is kind of going to be a clusterfuck, because that's BlazBlue Continuum Shift 2, Punch Time Explosion, and as of yesterday, Dead or Alive.
Well,
that's three fighting games the same day.
Yeah.
What the hell happened?
All right, well, the big, more interesting news after all this release schedule talk is the rumors have started to fly.
Of a Wii price drop.
Well, the Wii price drop is so uninteresting to me because, I mean, obviously I already have a Wii, but...
You're not counting the days?
The thing is, you can already get a Wii for like $179 at certain retailers.
Yep.
So dropping it officially from $199 to $149, I think effectively it's not really that significant of a drop, because if you're really bargain hunting for a Wii, you could have already had one for almost that little anyway. I think for $150 with two games and the Remote Plus, it's a good deal. It's a great system. There's a lot of stuff you can get for it. But people have been talking about how, you know, Nintendo's going to try to increase their hardware sales. And I think the problem at this point is not, there. I don't think there's that much price sensitivity on the Wii, and there never was. I think the main problem is that there's just not that many people left who don't have one and who still want it.
Yep.
From the very beginning, you could see that people were willing to pay whatever to get a Wii. So yeah. if you ever wanted one, you probably already have one.
Well, also, clearly, the thing is you can always release, you know, new software that has an appeal that will make people who didn't want one before want one now, but they are not doing... We went through the schedule, they're not doing it.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is going after the outliers that don't even buy game consoles normally. The far, far outlying people, or the far, far mainstream, however you want to look at it.
The PS2 sold very many consoles, as we know, but it still, you know, once the current generation got underway, did a very tidy living of selling at a low price. So, I mean, right. there's definitely a future for the Wii in that space.
Sure.
If indeed, I mean, to be clear, the rumors are that they're going to cut it to $149 in May.
Anyway, the really big, really interesting thing this week is that the rumors have begun to fly over the Wii's successor. So as of today, as of recording, there were three separate
Thursday.
News stories that came out from three different media outlets reporting that developer sources have confirmed to them that Nintendo is starting to show around some kind of concept for a new console.
So Genesis here is a Game Informer article that I guess is in their newest issue and went live on their website today. And then the other site started to report that, yes, we've seen this article. And then finally they're like, and now we've spoken to people and this is what we have.
Okay. So anyway, multiple outlets are confirming this. They're not all reporting the same story. They're saying, we heard this too, basically.
Right.
Which adds a lot of credence to it, I think, when you've got more than one site.
But the real story is not just that they're showing it around or developers are seeing it, but that they're going to discuss it in some fashion at this year's E3.
Yeah, which could mean a revolution type of announcement where Iwata holds up a piece of plastic and says, here's what it looks like.
Which calendar-wise would fit, because the information we're getting from these same reports is saying that the console itself will not launch until the latter part of 2012. So yeah. It would be the same kind of lag as, you know, Revolution.
Right. It does sound like they're going to be a bit more open about what they've got at that point.
And the other indications are that it'll be a machine that will output HD graphics, it'll
right.
be backwards compatible with Wii, and it will be comparable with the new systems, maybe more powerful,
so,
maybe not. It's
there's a bit of difference there.
Well, there's three lines of conversation that have come out from various sources. One is that it's going to be just under those two. There's a group that says it's going to be roughly commensurate.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a couple sources that are saying it's going to be significantly beyond
PlayStation 3.
Yes.
Which and PlayStation 3 is significantly more powerful than Xbox 360. So that would mean that if it was released today, it would be the most powerful console. Now, when it's released sometime in 2012, it may not be. But
yeah.
It would still be, obviously, much more powerful
What's
than the
confusing
Wii.
To me, personally, is how the sources can be so divergent unless Nintendo is intentionally showing them different things.
No, I think Nintendo is probably showing them some kind of... demo reel that was probably made on a computer, and this is different people's subjective opinion on how good it looked.
Mm.
That's why. I don't think Nintendo showed them specs yet. I think they probably showed them some kind of like sizzle reel kind of thing, and told them a few things about what they're aiming in terms of maybe the type of processor, how many cores, stuff like that. But even if they had the exact specifications, it might be difficult to say how powerful it is compared to other systems because of different architectures and different technologies.
Exactly.
So what's interesting is that, well, I mean, for me personally, from a technological standpoint, is that we'd heard in the past from Iwata that they wanted to be more engaged with developers and publishers early on in the lifecycle because they felt like they basically screwed the pooch on Wii by not engaging them ahead of time. Because remember, their operating theory was, well, it's basically the same architecture as a GameCube with more powerful hardware. So if you've developed on GameCube, you should be fine. Mm-hmm. But in reality, that may be true, but if you don't have a development kit to start developing for that control scheme, you're going to come up with stuff like we had at the start, which was a bunch of PS2 ports with tacked-on remote control. It felt like it was added the last minute.
And also, what if you didn't want to make games for the GameCube anymore?
Well, yeah, that was a big problem because a lot of the third parties that they wanted to court for the Wii weren't really making many GameCube games in the first place. And the other thing is, developers are techno nuts. So they don't necessarily want to develop on old hardware. They get excited for the new stuff. They want to flex their muscles a little bit. They want to stretch their abilities. So that's not necessarily a great opening line.
Right. Yeah. So their thought was that they need to be more engaged early. And a lot of what the Game Informer article talks about is developers saying that they've really been coming to us. And they've been really, really in tune with this kind of stuff we want to hear. I think one of them said the quote that they got it this time or something like that.
Yeah, they all seemed impressed, you know, these sort of anonymous quotes that the reports include.
But now we don't really know how many different sources are these. I mean, it could just be one guy who really likes to talk.
Well, I mean, the phrase multiple sources was thrown around, which could mean two. But it could mean 10.
So originally when the story, because all three of the main sources of the rumors were updating their articles consistently. Mm-hmm. So say around 4 o'clock Eastern time when it really started to come out till about, say, 7 o'clock Eastern time, they were constantly pushing updates to these same articles. And like it started the day. They weren't sure if it was back. They had all these things they weren't sure about, like motion controls, backwards compatibility, and other stuff. By the end of the day, at least two of them had said it is fully backwards compatible with Wii, which at the very least means it can use some kind of motion control.
I would expect that.
And one of them, I think it was IGN, said that Nintendo planned some kind of pre-announcement this month. I'm thinking somewhat in line with the 3DS, oh crap, they're onto us press release that we got about a year and a half ago.
Yeah, probably something out of Japan.
Yeah.
Like a one paragraph thing. Even for DS, it happened that way. It's like basically the new portable codenamed Nintendo DS has two screens. And that's all it said. And that's what we had for like 3 months before E3 when they finally showed the damn thing.
Let the mock-ups begin.
Well, I think Japan is, I think, might be the real issue here. I mean, it doesn't surprise me at all, you know, I don't think it surprises any of us that they've got the console in the works and that, you know, it's probably going to come out in 2012. But perhaps that they're going to start talking about it even before E3 is a bit surprising because, I mean, people go on about sales softening in North America and they have, you know, Xbox sells it consistently now, but some of that is because Xbox has grown.
Right.
Well, software sales are down a lot too.
Yeah, well, that's true. But, you know, Nintendo's hardware sales are down about, you know, a quarter year on year. They're still not selling far below Xbox and all that. You know, it's not that bad. But if you look at Japan, now, over 2010, they pretty much went neck and neck with Sony. Right. With PS3. But if you look at the recent figures, a lot of people look at the figures coming out of Japan, they look at 3DS and it's being, you know, marginally outsold by PSP or something, and that's what they look at. But if you tack on the DS numbers as well, I mean, Nintendo's still outselling them on portables. Right. But consoles now, week on week, Wii is selling about a third of what PS3 is selling, fewer than 10,000 units a week. I mean, it's really slowed down to a very pale shadow of what it's done in the past there, much more so actually than in America. So if you subscribe to the view that, you know, the Nintendo remains so terribly Japan-centric, that would suggest that, yeah, they're going to bring this stuff along, you know, just to keep themselves kind of relevant in the console space.
What's funny, though, is that some of the comments from these anonymous developers indicated that Nintendo was going to be trying to make a real concerted effort to court Western gamers with this particular piece of hardware.
Well, I think they should. I think if you see some of the strides they've kind of made with 3DS, I think it exhibits that they go to try and do, you know, everything at once to some extent, you know, so they're not mutually exclusive by any means.
Well, you know, I just think that the console's hardware isn't as important as its online infrastructure. I mean, if it doesn't have something that'll match Xbox Live or even PSN, I don't know.
I'm sure they're getting that feedback from the Western developers.
You've not done 3DS yet.
Would I be impressed by it?
I don't think you'd be impressed. I think
there's not much to say right now.
You'd be relieved.
I mean, think about it. For us owning the 3DSs right now, it's like NFL preseason. I mean, it's nice that
with
it's
a
here.
Lockout looming, yes.
Not quite. I'm all about preseason games. You know, it's like you wait this time. It's nice that it's here, but the real shots haven't been fired yet. You know, so with the eShop still waiting to come and all that kind of stuff, it's just right now. All I've done is like set it up. Like I've registered a bunch of friends on the forums, and I'll never have to register them again because it's one code, and I'm happy about that. And let's just, you know, wake me up on opening day.
Yeah.
What's funny is the rumor engine started up, you know, like the old Revolution rumor engine. And once this crap hit the internet, now it's almost impossible for us to start separating the sane from the insane.
Oh, it'll be silly season.
Oh, no, it already is. I mean, there's already...
This is the fun part. I mean, I started reading this shit today, and it immediately brought me back to, like, 1999, talking about the Star Cube and...
Dolphin.
The Nintendo 128 and Project Dolphin, and I love this shit. I love it.
Yeah, this is a fun part until the console actually comes out, and you're like, ah, fuck, they brought back friend codes again.
Well, so here's some of the crazy shit we've already heard, that there's screens on the controller that may or may not be 3D. I'm like, come on, no.
No, they'll be touch. I already talked about this. Come on, James. This is known. It's a fact.
This is when the shit starts to get crazy, and we're still in day zero here. So we've got at least until E3 of just complete batshit insanity to put up with. And of course, it's kind of odd that all of them had stuff ready to talk about this.
I think it was one of the cases where you see the report, you call your friends, your developer friends, you say, can you verify this? Yes. Or, since this is out, are you okay with me reporting what we talked about yesterday? That kind of thing. And that's probably why they're updating throughout the day, because they're on the phone with all these people, they're trying to verify certain details with their people. It's complex, but it's exciting.
See, now E3 is way more enticing for me, and now I think I'm going to have to ask for the time off. I'm glad I registered already, but
I just hope I get a job early enough that I can ask for time off by the time E3 comes around. Because if I get a job the week before E3, I'm not going to be able to go to E3, right?
It's going
to
be bad if I'm like the most senior staff member there. That's not going to go well.
You very well could be. Yeah, and I think it's interesting that everybody... I wonder if all these developers and the reporters that they're talking to are just assuming a late 2012 release, or if Nintendo's actually said something to them to that effect, because with the way that Wii sales are drying up, especially in Japan, with the success of the 3DS launch, which we just found out sold 400,000 units in a week in America, in less than a week, in 6 days.
Right.
And we don't know how much since then, because that was as far as NPD went with that report. But 3DS has done very well, and it was released in March, which is not exactly prime video game season.
With a relatively small push behind it as well, campaign-wise.
Yeah. And it was a worldwide release within 1 month. So they had to separate all their units out among all these different regions. And they did it very successfully. So I think it's feasible that the new console could release maybe after Christmas. I mean, I can sort of see this situation in which they put Zelda out there for Christmas, they sell as many Wiis and as many Wii games as they can in one last holiday season, and then let's get out the new console at least in Japan before the end of the fiscal year.
I don't think it's that far along.
Japan-wise, like I said, you've got to think about it, because some of the things that they might be able to prop up the Wii a little bit, you know, like Xenoblade or Last Story, I mean, Chris Cole thinks they're both coming eventually, I know.
Yeah. I hope he's right.
They might both come eventually a lot, but it's all already out in Japan. Xenoblade's been out for a year.
Well, there's Dragon Quest X.
They've still got Zelda and Dragon Quest.
That's still a big one to prop up the lineup, for
Kirby
sure.
Kirby a little bit.
But, I mean, if we're talking about going towards the end of 2012, that is a long time.
Yeah.
Well, now, see, the phrasing that I've seen repeated a few times is that the developers say they're, quote, targeting a late 2012, which seems to me it was an implied, or I mean not an implied, an explicit objective.
Could you imagine you have Zelda coming out at the end of the year, maybe Dragon Quest X comes at a similar point in Japan, and then a whole other year after that? What that would be like?
Bad.
They would have to fill it with something.
I mean, I'm sure, look, they've got stuff up their sleeve. Of course they do.
Are they at Capcom begging for another Monster Hunter? I mean,
you don't have to beg, just give them the money.
The next Monster Hunter on the Nintendo system is on 3DS.
Yeah,
yes,
for sure.
I agree. Anyway, it's very exciting, and it's kind of working out like I predicted so far, but I think as of E3, they're going to throw a big wrench into the works. It's just going to be something weird about this system that'll probably catch us all off guard, and it's going to be really fun to find out what it is.
You know, I'm worried they're going to come in and be like, see it, TGS, bitches! And they're motherfuckers.
And then at the very end, they'll have somebody jump out of a cake and say, hey, by the way, here's a console! Bow-bow!
I just don't want... I just don't want Iwata to walk out on stage holding an empty plastic shell over his head like it's the first brick from the Berlin Wall.
Yeah.
As long as it's more than that, I'll be happy.
Here's the thing. I mean, people forget this, but in 2005, here's what we knew about the Wii. About Revolution, okay? We knew what the system looked like, although it shrank a little bit before they finalized it. But we knew generally what it looked like. We knew that it would have some kind of virtual console system, which was a big deal, you know, and it has been a big deal as it wore out. And we had one game. They showed a very, very brief teaser for Metroid Prime 3. So I expect we'll know at least that amount of information about the next system after this E3.
That wasn't what everybody wanted to know about it, though. I mean,
we wanted the controller, of course.
Yeah, and Nintendo's like, no.
But here's the thing, the controller may not be the really big part of the system like it was for Wii.
No, and I don't think it will be, but I don't think we're going to get the really big part anyway.
No, they always play that pretty close.
They're not going to show much, if any, software for this thing. But the sky's the limit on hardware. I mean, they may well reveal as much as there is to be revealed. Just for the sake of their shareholders, for the sake of all the developers that they want to get on board early as possible. Especially if this thing's coming out in the spring in Japan, they need developers on it now. And that's why they're showing it, and that's why these leaks are coming out now. We got to end this, and this is totally off topic, sort of off topic, but I was just looking in a forum thread today. Someone was excited about all this, the Wii HD shit. They posted an image of Zelda Wind Waker running on the Dolphin emulator at super high resolution.
Yes.
It looked amazing, and I've seen that before, and I've always thought it looked amazing, and I thought, what if they made a Mario game with that kind of art style?
What if they made another Zelda game with that kind of art style? I would be thrilled.
We're done. That's new business. Time for a break. We'll see you later.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
We begin this week with reviews. Andy looks at Remote Racers for DSiWare, in which he compliments the visuals, but also notes that driving is virtually impossible.
Remotely raceable.
And then there's LEGO Star Wars 3. Nathan takes a look at this Wii version of the latest LEGO game, and what do you know? He loves it! Read the review to find out why.
And we got more reviews coming your way. Pro Evo Soccer 2011. Brand new staff member JP Insano Lord Corbin evaluates this 3D footy simulation and tells you whether or not it lives up to the series' excellent reputation. We also have a review from Zach. He's taken a look at Rango the video game on the DS. He turns in the verdict on the surprisingly good movie adaptation for the Nintendo DS. Not the 3DS, the Nintendo DS.
We also have brand new updated hands-on impressions of Zelda Ocarina of Time 3D. Because Aaron went to NOA in San Francisco and got a chance to play a new build of the upcoming 3DS remake, and he's more excited than before You definitely want to read his impressions to find out why. We've also got a new page in the ongoing feature called If I Were in Charge of Zelda.
Oof.
And this time Andrew takes his personal view on the Zelda series and decides that it could be freshened up by adding in a little bit of gender switching.
That was an interesting experience to read first.
You
want to
read this? It has art too.
Yeah, there's art.
There are visual aids.
There is some fantastic talkback responses, which I preface talkback saying, ooh, this is going to be contentious. And it was.
That's right. So if Andrew were in charge of Zelda, interesting things would happen.
That is definitely true. Josh is responsible for this week's Extra Life, in which he shares the sweet memories of playing Mario Party 2 with his friends. And we have a complete news blowout with our new staff writers and our old staff writers like myself, who are cranking out lots of news stories every day. So be sure to visit the site for the latest word on everything Nintendo, like the fact there's a rumor replacement for Wii coming to be announced in the next month or two.
Yeah, this stuff is changing day to day, so...
It's just how news tends to behave, yes.
Right, so you really don't want to depend on this podcast for the latest word. So be sure to go check out all of the stuff at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back, everyone. It's time for Retroactive. This is the 17th edition of our ongoing feature in which we all play the same game and get together and talk about it. And we invite you to play it as well and join in a forum discussion, and we'll read some of your comments to help guide the discussion here. So for this edition, we actually chose a game. Normally we have a vote, but we wanted a little bit of a break.
Democracy sucks.
We chose a shorter, easier game. Not easier, but definitely shorter for this one. A little bit easier to get into than some of the other ones, certainly compared to Ogre Battle 64.
I find that game imminently easy to get into.
And so we ended up going with The Legend of the Mystical Ninja for Super NES. It's a game that I played back in the early 90s when it first came out, and then I actually already had this on Virtual Console because I had bought it kind of in the early days of the wild, wild west of Virtual Console, where I was likely to buy anything that seemed remotely interesting. But I did start it over from the beginning. Had all of us played this before at some point, or was this brand new to anyone?
I hadn't played it before.
I hadn't played it either.
I had played it before. I rented it way back in the
John
day.
John was the mystical ninja of legend.
Yes. 16th century Robin Hood-like.
John played it back in Edo.
In big, giant fucking text and all.
So, just to give a quick overview of what the hell this game is, in case you have not played it and did not...
I actually still need help with what the hell this game is, so please,
well,
by all means.
That's understandable. It's an action-adventure game. It's a very early Super NES game. It actually was originally released in 1991 in Japan. It took almost a full year for it to come out in America, and even longer
and
in
fun
Europe.
Trivia note, release date in Europe, 1994.
Wow.
What?
That's
that
awesome.
Is completely true.
I bet that game amazing. Didn't seem horribly dated at all when it came out.
Really?
Yeah, so we didn't have to wait quite that long in America, but it was still a pretty long wait. But, you know, this game is certainly pre-Zelda. In Japan, it was pre-Castlevania, which I think is interesting on a technical level, because this is a Konami game. And you can tell that they were sort of trying out a few of the technologies that would be used a lot more in Castlevania 4. Even though, I mean, this was like half a year earlier, so it's not drastically
different. It's a few months. I'm sure they would be developed concurrently.
Yeah, but I think they were trying a few things out in this game. So anyway, it's an action-adventure game. It's very Japanese. It's ostensibly set in ancient Japan. That's why they refer to Edo, which is like the ancient name of Tokyo, the old capital. But, of course, it's full of weird anachronisms, all kinds of modern technology, weird cultural references to things that were fairly new at the time. And you can play the first level of Gradius. So it's not exactly as historically
with Super
accurate.
Nintendo level of synth, which I personally enjoy a lot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a very wacky game. The characters are totally bizarre. There's a lot of strange, funny character animations, especially with the enemies. And the story makes no sense at all. It's not, I don't think it's translated poorly at all, actually.
There are some moments where I would argue that's not the case.
It's kind of difficult to tell. I actually played the Japanese version because as long-time listeners will know, I'm a bit of a stickler for the whole 50Hz, 60Hz thing. So even though it is on the Virtual Console in Europe by virtue of it actually coming out in 1994, I elected to go with the Japanese version. I have played two of its sequels on the Japanese Virtual Console before, and managed to enjoy them despite the language barrier, so I didn't really think there was going to be a problem there. But, you know, with this sort of thing, there's not that much text, but I could still imagine they probably did some chopping when they did the localization back then.
There are some pieces of conversations that feel like they're kind of missing, or just like, welcome to the store. This is where you buy things. Do you want to buy things? And you
know. Yeah, you could really tell they only had so much room to work with for the text.
It's probably a little bit more utilitarian than its Japanese counterpart. Probably had a little bit of that color because it's just so ridiculous. Everything you look at is pretty much ridiculous. So surely the characters should speak in somewhat more ridiculous manner.
Yeah, there's some aspects of the writing that I think are probably intentionally funny and some that maybe aren't, but it's a step up from what we were used to in the 8-bit era, I would say.
This is the lottery. Do you want to play the lottery?
Right.
Yes.
So it's a mixture of town areas, which are kind of presented in this 3/4 view. It's not quite overhead, but it's not side-scrolling either. You can move up and down in the plane as well as left and right. And those are basically a lot of people run at you from the sides of the screen for no apparent reason.
Yeah, they just hate you.
Especially initially, most of these characters that are running around look quite innocent.
Yes.
And then you realize, no, you have to beat them all up. Apart from the women, who are worth money.
Who are prostitutes, yes.
The geishas, yeah.
They're prostitutes. They have to be.
They're geishas. They're not prostitutes. There's a difference.
It's quite alarming. It's like if you inadvertently, in the midst of bashing everything that moves with your little clay pipe, happen to hit a woman, then that costs you like 100 yen
yes,
or whatever.
Yes.
Same with deer. You can't hit deer.
Women are worth 50 yen alive and 100 yen dead. Think about that. That's the kind of messages this game is sending to people.
It's a kind of biting social commentary about ancient Japan that this game contains.
Yes. It is kind of... I found that the overworld to be completely obnoxious because more often than not, you're just spending time slowly crawling around while you're being attacked.
The movement speed is the real issue with these bits.
Well, I mean, it's that can be upgraded, as I'm sure we all are aware, by buying sandals for some reason.
Not by much, though.
Oh, I mean, if you've got the third level of sandals, then you are pretty fast then.
Yeah, and if you just keep buying more and more sandals, because the game somewhat vindictively takes things away from you when you get hit, because obviously if you get hit, you need less items.
Yeah,
well, this is the thing. I commented on this in the forum thread, like this part of the game, where it's kind of like a brawler. Style sort of sections where you're beating people up for money, and although at the same time unlike Final Fight or something, you're going into shops and just random people's houses and talking to NPCs, so it's a bit adventure-y in that way. But the gameplay's kind of brawlery, but it has this real 8-bit vibe because you start off with this attack range that is piffling.
It's very Double Dragon-ish.
Mm-hmm.
And as you say, you get upgrades to your attack range, you get upgrades to your movement speed, but they can be lost just by taking hits. It's got a very 8-bit feel, and the real reason for that is because those parts of this game are heavily based on two Famicom Goemon games, which played pretty much the same. They had elements there. They didn't have the side-scrolling platform levels, but the actual brawler town parts were very, very similar. And I think, being as this was, a very early Super Famicom game, the game design kind of sensibilities just came over largely intact.
Yeah. And the way it punishes you with losing abilities when you get hit is actually replicated in Cave Story, for instance, which is essentially a fake 8-bit game. It's a tribute to that 8-bit sensibility.
I just found the overworld part to be largely unenjoyable because most of the time is spent just slowly creeping along, trying not to get hit.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's one thing. I mean, we're talking about the issue of having your speed debt, you know, upgraded because you beat people up, you get money, you buy the upgrade, and then it gets taken away when you get hurt. But the real thing for me is not so much that dynamic, but actually just how slow you are to start with. If you're going to have that upgrade downgrade sort of thing, just make the original movement speed more palatable, more tolerable, and I think it wouldn't be as bad.
Well, actually, for me, it's more a function of just having health when you finally get to the boss, because you can buy
those. You have to play conservatively.
You can buy those pizzas to give you more continues, but ultimately, there's not a lot of options for regenerating health in the field.
You can find certain levels that might be hidden, like the golden cat, which not only fills your health, but actually extends it. So they're really worth finding if you can find. One of the interesting part, like in the very first level, and I'm sure that I actually found another case of this, although I think there are more cases of it. But in the very first level in that kind of graveyard, there's a secret cave that you can find. So this is in the side-scrolling part after you've kind of been in the town. But you find a secret cave where you kind of go back to the town-style gameplay, but all it is just a cave filled with items. But it has certain items that you can only get to if you brought in the maximum movement speed. So if you got the 3 sandals or whatever, kept them intact, went into the side-scrolling level, and then found this secret hidden area, then you could, I think you could get like a golden cat and some extensions to your weapons and stuff, and that really helps. So I thought that was an interesting kind of interactivity between what you were doing in the town stages and then what you were doing in the side-scrolling bit. But then as the rest of the game went on, that certainly didn't progress or get more intricate or anything. It seems pretty much just localized to that one example from my experience.
So what's funny, though, is the sandals isn't, to me, the bigger deal as the weapon, because you can actually buy more than 3 sandals, and I assume he just keeps them in his back pocket.
Yeah.
I think you can basically buy as many as you can afford, unlike the pizza where you're limited to 3.
Well, James, I don't know if you got this far, but you can also buy armor that...
Yeah, you can.
...that keeps you from losing as much health when you get hit. You'll still lose your weapon upgrade, but that's fairly easy to replenish.
It effectively acts like a shield. Like, I think you can buy 2 of them.
Yeah, and the later ones will absorb more hits as you get to later towns.
Yeah.
Right. I felt like the early part of the game was really punitive.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you're like, why is everybody attacking me, and why does everything I get go away?
Yeah. Well, what I didn't understand, I mean, in the first part there, like when you, on the kind of road to the first boss, once you get out of the town area, first off, you run up against this creature where you don't know what the hell it is. Turns out it's what, like raccoon dog?
Yeah, that's what they call it, is raccoon dog.
Yeah, it's a giant tanuki statue.
Yeah, so the first time I went through it,
did you try to attack it?
Yeah, well, I had the choice to continue, and I could start back in the town, I think, or start back at raccoon dog, and I was like, what the hell is raccoon dog? I don't want to start at raccoon dog. It's like, what the hell does that even mean?
This is another case for playing the Japanese version. I never experienced any of this confusion despite not being able to read the text at all.
Yeah.
See, for me, I had found this little elephant save thing right before the boss. So
it's like a checkpoint.
My choices were raccoon dog or elephant one.
Elephant one. Yeah, that's exactly it. I'm like raccoon dog. And I was like, oh my God, first off, I didn't even know that was a raccoon or a dog.
It's horrible Brundlefly hybrid.
It's got its jaw open unnaturally with it's fucking awful.
It was awful.
But your choices are, and it's actually in the text doesn't actually line up right. So raccoon dog or elephant one are kind of askew. You're like, what in God's name is going on this fucking screen?
Yeah, I gotta say, like the first time I started playing this, I was completely confused because I didn't know that you could get more speed. I didn't know that you could buy a shield. I didn't know that you could also sit there and pretty much gear grind.
Yeah,
you can just sit there and move the screen back and forth so the enemies respawn. That's classic 8-bit.
Yeah.
and just sit there until you get all the best gear and then go in and fight the boss. I mean, the boss kicked my ass the first few times. I was like, what the hell? And then finally, I was like, "Oh, I'll just gear grind," and there you go.
I had an issue with the first boss. The first boss shoots these disc things at you, and you have to knock them back at them. And what I ran into with it is if it just fractionally grazes up against you, you're hit.
Yeah.
But you have to hit that with your weapon. You have to hit that fucker dead center.
Yep.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of things with that. I mean, first of all, one thing that I noticed, especially in, like, the town sections, this could be harsh, is the fact that there's not, like, a real invincibility window once you get hit once.
No, there isn't. Yeah.
So that's harsh in itself. And second of all, I think some of the issues with, like, maybe, you know, like, hit detections is just because if you're using, like, the minimal attack range, you have to put yourself really close to the thing that's going to hurt you mm-hmm. to hit it.
Right.
So you're really testing the boundaries of, you know, that hit detection stuff because you have no choice unless you're going to actually throw money at it, literally. That is the other attack. You have a projectile attack which costs money because you're throwing coins right. at it, which certainly makes it easier, but...
It's very useful.
It's extraordinarily useful. The question is, are you going to do, you know, what John talked about, where you just grind for money, you know, not only to buy stuff, but just to use as a weapon? Or are you going to try and just play it more straight up? I mean, I generally just tried to go through it pretty much, you know, without doing a lot of grinding and stuff, which ironically, I probably end up doing grinding of a different sort, which is playing through the level until I understand it to the point that I
yeah.
can,
yeah.
you know.
That was unappealing. I mean...
I'm more amenable to learning a level by playing through it a bunch of times than I am to scrolling enemies routinely and getting money off them.
Where I was doing that was right before the boss, but one of the things that annoyed me was the fact that I could get hit from any angle, but I could only attack north, south, east, west.
Yeah, that's true.
So you just get hit like a whole bunch of cheap times.
By a fish that's flopping around on the ground.
Yeah.
I'm not scared of a motherfucking fish,
yeah, like,
honestly.
Like the fish can move in any direction kind of thing. And there was a lot of times when I was just like, wow, I feel like I can't get out of the way of this properly because it's going to hit me on some angle that I can't defend against.
So when I beat the first boss after God knows how many tries and having to walk all the way back there, the game doesn't have a checkpoint after you beat that boss.
Yeah.
So if you die...
But you move to the next chapter.
No, you don't. Not immediately. You have to make it down to the travel agency first.
Oh, that's true. That's the only time in the game I think that
happens.
I was
walking to the travel agency and got killed by a fish. I had to replay the whole level.
Because
what Johnny says is true. The rest of the time, anytime you beat a boss, it just does that little transition where you get that little mode 7 map of Japan
thing. That particular
thing.
One, and it's kind of far from the travel agency, too. That particular one, I was so mad. I was like, you know what, game? F you. I don't need this.
Yeah. I felt that the intro to the game was particularly harsh. Like, the first area, the first boss, all that kind of stuff, it's just very harsh.
It just kind of throw you into the deep end, especially because, like, you wouldn't have accumulated a lot of money. I mean, I didn't really do this because, I mean, the way I played the game was, like, you know when you die, you lose all your lives, like, you lose everything.
Yep.
Yeah,
you don't have any. You don't have any items anymore, you don't have any money anymore. But the thing about it is, if you, say, for instance, accumulate a bunch of stuff and then go and save at the travel agents... Like, what it does is it gives you a password, which, certainly, I am not going to enter that many Japanese characters. I'm not going to write down that many Japanese characters.
And it's a terrible password, too. I mean, it's
got, like, hyphens
and
dashes.
It's like colon,
bullshit.
Semicolon, hyphen, like, just...
Apostrophe.
Like, 35 characters. It was like...
On Virtual Console, there's no need to write down those passwords.
But that's the thing, see, with Virtual Console, it's got, at first, it was like, right, so I never have to worry about going to the travel agents, because I knew the travel agents how you save, because it's the same way in subsequent Goemon games that I have played. So I just, oh, no, I didn't need to bother with that, because, you know, I'm playing on Virtual Console, suspend state, just keep going. But the thing is that later on in the game, I kind of found that it would be useful because you don't have to manually enter the password to continue from that point. You could just elect to do it from the menu.
Yeah, it creates a checkpoint. So when you die later, you can go back there and you'll have all your stuff that you had when you... It's saving the game, basically.
Exactly.
That password includes information about how much money you have, how much armor you have, etc.
Yep. And where this really comes in, like I said, for me, I didn't really feel like I needed to have the armor or this, that, and the other to beat most of these levels. So after a few tries, you get better at it.
Well, the platforming is more difficult than the combat, so
yeah,
that's a valid way to play it, is without buying a bunch of armor.
Yeah, exactly. You're going to die from falling in a pit or whatever. You know, I mean, the armor isn't going to save you from that anyway. But later on in the game, really towards the end, they start to ask more of you to actually get access to the side-scrolling level after the town. So, for instance, like, you'll have to buy some pass, like literally just like a ticket or something that costs nearly 1,000.
Now,
you wouldn't want to grind for that. And you don't really have to grind too much, because usually you can find, like, in the later towns at least, there's like some hidden areas that have got a lot of money in them. So you could normally rack up like quite a few hundred pretty quickly, and then you might have to get a bit more. And you could play mini games. There's some easy money mini games.
Right. The whack-a-mole one is pretty much a guaranteed 300 every time.
And also, like, there's that first person maze thing is very good for getting extra lives.
Yeah.
Because if you find everything in the maze, you recoup your entry fee, but also get a life. And so you could just do it again and just keep getting life. So, but there's exploitable stuff with the mini games if you really want to get into that kind
now,
of stuff. But
do you know if that maze, is that maze randomly generated, you know?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I was unable to complete said maze because I just...
The key thing with the maze is you have to press, I think it's B, or one of the buttons brings up a map.
Oh, what the fuck?
I had no idea. I had fucking no idea of that.
It's almost like a joke, because the thing is, once you see the map, like, it doesn't show you everything until you actually collect the map.
Oh my god.
If you just press B, you'll see where you've been, right? But if you've collected the map, it'll just show you everything.
Bitch, I was trying to figure out where I had been. I was like, I have no idea how to get
out. No, because this is like an old school screen by screen first person maze game.
Yeah.
And everything looks the same.
Yeah.
It's like the mazes in Phantasy Star 1 or Fester's Quest.
I was like, yep. I'm never going to get out of here.
I never even played the maze.
Yeah, I wound up actually leaving through where I entered, and it said that if you do that, you can't keep anything that you got in the maze. So I got nothing.
It doesn't give you a choice. It tells you after the fact. So you've already stepped out the door.
But that's the thing. Then I was like, well, I don't have a map, so I'm not going to try and find my way out of this. So.
Well, you didn't have a choice anyway, John, because as soon as you hit the button, you were out the door.
But anyway, I mean, the point is, if you've got a situation like that, where you have had to have done quite a lot of work to set yourself up to get into the action stage, obviously that you're going to want to save first. You never have to do all that busy work again. Unfortunately, because of the virtual console space, that you don't actually have to go through the onerous process of entering those ridiculous passwords. It works well.
Apostrophe, yeah. Semicolon, plus sign, L.
This is really interesting reversal of fortune from Ogre Battle 64, because that's a game where James has played it so many times that a lot of the things that we struggled with understanding, he doesn't even think about anymore. And I think that's maybe my experience, and maybe to some extent yours, Greg, since you played the sequels. But
yeah.
Because I've played this game multiple times over the course of nearly 20 years, there's things like buying a bunch of sandals and going to the logbook lady and saving my progress that I just don't even think about it. Like, I just know that that's the right way to play it.
It makes no sense that you would save at a travel agency. It's like...
When you walk in, she says, would you like me to save your progress in the
logbook? Yeah, I know, but I was like, well, that's a person selling briefcases, apparently. I'm not a businessman.
The weird thing is, like, let's say for instance, Goemon 3, the travel agency, like, you can actually warp around this, like, Zelda-style overworld that exists there, so the travel agency actually does what it tells you it is.
Well, it does in this game, too, though.
But only in the first level.
Only
it's only
the
time. First level that you have the travel agency, and then you...
After that, it's a save point.
So it doesn't really make that much sense that you save at the travel agency.
Especially since when you talk to her, she goes, oh, well, this is from here, you can travel all over the place. What travel package do you want? I don't know what the fucking travel package
is. The only thing that
mean?
Affects is just like if you buy the cheap one, like you're just in a wooden bucket, basically, like paddling.
It's a joke.
While Ibisamaru rides a whale or something. It's. You know.
But what amuses me actually was I played the gambling games a lot, not the lottery, because that's full on crazy, but like the whack-a-mole, because it's basically free money.
Right, yeah.
And, I realized that if you want to play again, you have to leave and come back in.
Yeah, a lot of that menu-based stuff is very primitive, the way the game handles it.
It's kind of a weird game that way. It doesn't do a lot of things you expect it to do, because of its age, and because if this game came out now, people would be shocked.
Bemused.
Well, we have a forum post that speaks to that a little bit.
Is it in big letters? In big letters.
I love the gigantic text size on the cutscenes.
I kind of imagine in that opening scene where, because the text is just as big in the Japanese.
I assumed it was because they just cut the text down. Like, all right, we have a lot of black space to deal
kind
with.
Kind of imagine that when Goemon and Ibisuara are talking, that they're actually like sitting across from each other at Bruce Wayne's dinner table, and they're just shouting really loud so that they can hear each other.
That's pretty much what I've imagined. I'm like, why is everyone yelling? What's going on?
Yeah, so in the official Retroactive Forum thread, we had some we had a few good posts from the listeners about this, and NoName2200 said, "I appreciate how the game makes it clear from the first minute that it's going to be unapologetically goofy. I kind of like the mini games. They're all simple, but aside from the maze, they all require some skill, and they offer enough money to make them worth your while without ever being required to advance."
Yeah, I mean, they're certainly not required. I barely played any of them.
I would argue Mole is in no way, shape, or form a skill-based game.
Isn't there like concentration as well? And so it's not.
They're more like work. But then there's a couple. when you get to the amusement park, you finally get the option to play the arcade games. And the two, I don't know, Greg, you might be able to tell me if there's more later on, but the two at that point are an Arkanoid clone that's not very good.
Yeah.
And the first level of Gradius.
They're the only two I saw, but again, I didn't really mess around too much with those, because first of all, like, you can't earn money from playing those, unlike
the
other
games.
That's
right, you spend money to play it. It's just for fun.
And I think, because I said I didn't grind and have lots of money. Money was a little bit scarce for a lot of the games, so I wanted to see the Gradius minigame. But other than that, I wasn't that desperate to try the arcade after I'd kind of seen that.
The cool thing about the Gradius thing is that it's the first instance I can think of basically like in-game emulation. I mean, this was very, very novel at the time. Being able to play one video game inside of another is not something that we'd ever seen before, and it was a strange thing. I mean, this was like a very infamous element of the game. The fact that you could play Gradius inside of Legend of the Mystical Ninja was very well known at the time.
That you could play a better game inside of this one.
it's just a really strange feature, because if you think about it, on NES, what would you emulate? You know, like, it was the first time that there were subsequent generations of gaming that could actually be emulated inside of each other. I mean, like, you know, now with Virtual Console, even with Animal Crossing and stuff like that, it became not that strange to see, but this was really weird. So the next forum post is from Killerman Yarrow, who posted, "The top-down sections of each zone are much more akin to a brawler than Zelda. I'm strongly reminded of River City Ransom, particularly in the amusingly agape, wide-eyed expressions of the enemies as they die. Unfortunately, so far, the AI seems quite basic, with your foes not even actively attacking you in many cases, so these sections haven't been all that engaging. Why didn't anybody tell me that this game had such a great soundtrack? Given Konami's reputation during this era, perhaps this shouldn't be such a shock. Anyway, I love the sound of Japanese instruments, which really helps with the game's thematic unity as well. Plus, it's a good one for surround sound because of those driving bass lines."
Yeah, well, I mean, the soundtrack's very good. It's got that, obviously, that very strong Japanese theme to it, but it's also got this sort of playful kind of funkiness at times. So the closing levels goes a little bit more kind of game-ish, a little more like you've heard from Konami and other games. I mean, I was certainly expecting that because it's really good in the sequels too. But Konami had some of the best soundtracks on NES. And God, did they grab the ball by the horns with the Super Nintendo hardware, the stuff they did. Gradius 3 is fantastic.
Super Castlevania 4.
Castlevania 4 is fantastic. And they all came out within the first year of the system being on sale in Japan.
Mm-hmm. Specifically for the music of this game, there's a lot of use of things like the shamisen and like a biwa. And like you mentioned, the drums, like the taikos. It's stuff that the SNES sound kit could do, and if you play a lot of SNES, like I've emulated a bunch of Japan-only SNES games to see what they were like back in the day, and most of them are really bizarre and make no sense, like completely menu-based soccer games. But you heard these things the SNES sound kit was capable of, but just didn't happen in games that we saw. So it's kind of interesting to see them get utilized in a game at all, because you could play a lot of SNES games and literally be unaware of the fact that it has these instruments in its
repertoire. Yeah.
Well, actually, I want to take that point and enlarge it, because if you think about the context in which this game came out, this was, I mean, the series, the Ganbare Goemon series, existed in the arcade and on the NES in Japan, but this is the first game in the series that came to the West, and it made a very strong impression on me at the time in 1992 when it finally came out in the summer of that year, because this was by far the most Japanese video game I had ever seen. I mean, it's just, the thing about it is, if you look back at the NES, because of the, you know, the lower graphical quality, the lower musical quality, it's more difficult to address that kind of cultural impact. You know, like, it's harder to include these elements like Japanese musical instruments and detailed graphics that really evoke Japan. Whereas on Super Nintendo, now they had the power to actually kind of do that. And for whatever reason, Konami thought, let's finally bring this series over. And I'd never seen anything like this. And, I mean, this was maybe the first time in my life that I'd really heard Japanese music, for instance. You know, like traditional Japanese music. Probably the very first time I'd ever heard it. So it's not as striking now, because that stuff is just much more accessible these days. But at the time, it was a really big deal. I mean, obviously the game is totally bizarro anyway, but the fact that it was so Japanese, I mean, it's unapologetically extremely
Japanese. I think unapologetically is kind of a good word, because I think, you know, if you think of the late 80s, you know, some of the kind of media coverage about Nintendo taking over your living room and all that, I don't think Japanese game companies releasing stuff in the West wanted to play up the fact that they were Japanese. That was,
yeah, sometimes they changed character art and, you know, things like,
sometimes they did that a lot.
Yeah, they were very much trying to downplay the origins of these things, and, you know, because they didn't think that it would be a good perception to have where it was coming from, just because of Japan's rise as an economic power at the time. There was a certain amount of paranoia about that, and of course the history with the war and everything, whereas I guess by the 90s, you know, that was beginning to thaw a little bit, and people felt it was less of something to be danced around.
Right.
And I think Killer Man's River City Ransom comparison is actually really good. It's a very, very astute observation.
You know, the game I thought of while I was playing it, although there's some parallel and there's obviously some major dissonance there, is it reminds me a lot of trying to play Muramasa. Lots of fucking wandering around with nowhere in particular to go, trying to find the objective. The primary difference is that in Muramasa, you can run forever and not find anyone to fight. In this game, you run forever and you fight every single person in Japan.
Well, yeah, that's why the River City Ransom makes a lot more sense, because that is an 8-bit game, and in a design sense, Legend of the Mystical Ninja is very similar to that. I mean, I think it's not as good in some ways, but, you know, River City Ransom was the first game to meld these sort of RPG elements, going into shops and buying things, grinding, leveling up your character, etc., and exploring. And it's very non-linear, so integrating that with the brawler gameplay, it's a very good comparison, actually, to Legend of the Mystical Ninja. Although the combat in this game, in the Super Nintendo game, is simpler.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that, as I said, I mean, it's pretty much lifted out of these Goemon games that were on Famicom, but even on Famicom, they were still half a game.
Right.
Because you had these, like, top down, they were like Zelda stuff, to go back to that part of Kilimanjaro's point. There is a history of Goemon having Zelda-style elements in the various games, but not this one. Like, so the Famicom games had Zelda-like stuff alongside the River City Ransom kind of stuff. Then you've got Goemon 3, which I've played, which has a big Zelda-style overworld that you explore, and you basically get pieces of heart, and there's lots of things about it that are like Zelda. And then you've got the one on N64, which is very much like Ocarina of Time.
It's a precursor to Ocarina.
It actually is before it, yeah. But then the other one on N64 is a side-scroller. I mean, that's the thing about Goemon.
It just goes all over the place.
The history of this franchise, I think, is utterly fascinating. I would recommend going to, if you're interested in this at all, to go to hardcoregaming101.net. They've got a series of pages about the whole history of the franchise. It's amazing how many games there have been. It's amazing how much ground they cover in terms of genre, and there's some particularly hilarious things where they tried to reboot the franchise around about, I think, the PS1, PS2 era.
Oh, the PS2 game is painful. That game shut down working designs.
They gave everything like an anime makeover. So like Ibisumaru, the fat, goofy sidekick, became this cute little anime girl with a giant hammer. I mean, it's just horrific. God. And the stuff that's happened, the twists and turns, and all that, it's gripping stuff. The history of this franchise.
So does this franchise actually have kind of a purpose? And what I mean by that is it used for them to try stuff out, or is it...
I think you have to think that the primary thing was in Japan anyway. It must have been pretty commercially successful. I mean, they kept slapping him on a bunch of different... I think it's been in puzzle
three
games.
Three Super Famicom games, you've got...
Four. There's four.
Four, okay. There's three on N64 in Japan. One of them's a board game. You got at least two on the DS. The first two or three Super Famicom games were ported to GBA in Japan.
That's right. The first two.
It's not like a launch experiment thing. I mean, they're released throughout the console life cycles. It's just a popular series. And understandably, it doesn't have as much cachet in the West.
But having said that, I think the DS is the early DS games that came out. TYP mentions it in the forum thread, which had like polygonal characters on a static background. The static backgrounds look a lot like Okami before Okami, because they were trying to get the Japanese art and all that. But that was pretty much where it stopped. Evidently, it stopped selling in Japan, and they don't make games of it anymore. It's just dead, which is quite sad.
James doesn't agree with that last point, but...
I don't hate the game or anything. I just feel like it's so incredibly anachronistic that it's almost impossible to play it for the first time now and be
That's what it is. I mean, that is the word of this game. There's no doubt about it. But this, I mean, the thing is, this isn't the best representation of the Goemon games. Certainly, I would say 2 and 3 are more interesting. I've heard some good things about, what was done on N64 and stuff. I mean, so to go back, to get away from the town stuff, talk about the side-scrolling things. The second one, the immediate sequel, that basically is an all-out side-scroller, virtually, right? You see, you've got a Super Mario World-style map where you select the levels, and then you also have the giant robot boss battles that are kind of like Punch-Out at the end.
Oh, yeah. Those were made very famous on the N64.
So going back to this one, it has much less side-scrolling content, and then what's padding it out with getting money and, all that, it feels a lot more like padding, whereas when you get to the second one, it feels a lot more like, this is all killer, no filler kind of stuff. But also, just in terms of the basics, like the platforming mechanics, the jumping and all, it all feels a bit tighter when you get to the second one, probably because it was a later game, and just because it was strictly a platformer, that is the focus of the game. So the mechanics have to be really good, and they're definitely better in the second one. So it's interesting looking back at it, and I still enjoyed it. I finished it. I beat it tonight, actually, just before the show.
It's a very tough game. That's an impressive accomplishment.
So even having played those superior games, and they're quite different to each other, but I would still say they're both better than this one, I still enjoyed it. But, you could see it's just, this was an early game. It hadn't fully strode into the 16-bit era yet. There are the graphical tricks are surprisingly impressive. Knowing that it was before Castlevania 4, some of the bits, like where you're in the castle or wherever it is, where you've got the rotating poles and the platforms on that and all that, I'm really surprised it looks as good as it does. I mean, it's certainly not as vibrant as the sequels again. Because when you start, like the first level, the background's very plain, like you're two color or something.
Yeah.
Kind of like Super Ghouls and Ghosts. So it's like, oh, well, it's showing its age. It's not as... But later on, it's really quite impressive for an early Super Nintendo game. But in terms of the game design, they hadn't quite caught up to that yet.
Well, do you think that they were just kind of rushing it to get it out around launch?
I'm sure there was some of that. I mean, it wasn't that. It was like, I think, 7 months or something after the Japanese launch. But, it was an early game, and it was just like, there's not as much substance there. There's plenty of flash. You've got all the Mode 7 stuff. You've got that giant...
A lot of fireworks animations between levels. Every level ends with fireworks.
You've got the bosses, you've got that giant face, like the Japanese Mr. Potato Head thing that comes in and out of the screen. There's lots of your very ostentatious stuff in it that's really fun, but you know, they hadn't quite got to the point where they had everything built around it yet. Mm-hmm. And so it's a shame that those subsequent games that really kind of nailed it for me never made it out of Japan.
Yeah, I did have to laugh at the fact that the map was done in mode 7. I just got a kick out of it because it's just so pointless. It does nothing. It's just like...
I mean, the map itself is relatively unimportant.
That's right up there with when you change sides in Super Tennis.
Oh, God. I forgot about that.
It takes ages. It's like, just get on with it. I don't care that it's broken.
It takes longer to actually do that in the game than it does in real life.
Yep.
Oh, God.
So one of the interesting things Greg mentioned is that the town parts start to feel like padding, and I think that's especially true as you get later in the game, and I started to feel that even by the fourth or the fifth.
I felt that by the third time I had to play the first one.
Yeah, seriously, I mean, right off the bat, I was like, I can completely skip this entire town part. It doesn't matter. Like,
you pretty much can in a lot of cases. It sounds like Greg pretty much did just blaze right through.
Oh, I did, but there is that part, as I said, where you get towards the very end where you can't because you've got that 980 yen ticket to buy. Mm-hmm.
That's awful.
No, I mean, it is padding, no doubt. It's more explicitly so towards the end.
It feels like it even before that, because as you start to get through three or four of the side-scrolling levels, you start to really appreciate those because they get longer and more intricate each time. The bosses are very interesting, very challenging. I'm kind of stuck on one right now, but I mean, I'm fighting this boss on a kite, and it's tilting left and right, and he's a bastard. Yeah, he's a playable character in the N64 game, but
he shows up in the next game as a playable character as well.
Yeah,
the Clockwork Ninja Sasuke, I think his name is, or something.
Right, yeah, he's a robot. I mean, the side-scrolling levels are very interesting, and they're fun. I mean, they're definitely the meat of the game, but the problem is you have all these towns that are very repetitive, because the difference between one town and the next is that the enemies are different sprites.
And items cost more.
The items cost more, and the shops are just rearranged in different locations. But the problem is, because there's not really level design in the towns, you know, they're just kind of, here's the stuff, just walk through it and get to the end so you can go to the action level, they start to feel very repetitive, and it feels like something to be endured more than something to be played, which that feeling may onset at different stages for different people, as you can tell here, but it will hit you at some point. It's like, wow, I really don't need to play the town part. Mm-hmm. The game is the side-scrolling, and that part's good.
I would be happier if the towns were just something to explore and I didn't have to slowly deal with the just oncoming wave of human flesh out.
Yeah, that's the main problem, is that the enemies are way too frequent. There's just like an onslaught. And some of them, and this is rare, but there are a few enemies that have attacks that are almost impossible to avoid.
Yes.
Yeah, the guys that throw the coins.
That throwing bastard.
The coin guy is...
You have to jump.
I don't understand what... I've tried jumping. I mean, maybe
what you have to do is jump into him and hit him. Like, don't try and jump over the coins. Jump at him.
Yeah, I don't think you can jump over the coins. Anyway, he's total bullshit, and he runs in very fast. You have almost no time to react, and he will hit you almost every time. It's like that kind of stuff does not make the game more fun.
I mean, later on, you get into kind of a real problem, because on the one hand, it's like, if you don't do something to kind of make these town sections more sort of meaningful, then, you know, they're just going to be perfunctory throughout. But then when they do, it just kind of makes them more of an impediment. You know, like I said, you are collecting more money to buy this pass. I mean, there's some good things in that. Like one of the towns, there's quite a lot of secret areas that you have to find and stuff, which, you know, there's some level design there. There's some gameplay there. But again, it does bog things down pace wise. But I do like the very end of the game, the preposterousness of it. The town is actually a prison. So all the villagers are now like cells with people in, but they still have all the shops, and you still have random women walking around. you have to make sure you don't hit.
It feels like they're worth a lot more than $50 in prison.
But here's where you get, like, guards with guns and stuff, and that is a bit much.
Well, we have a couple more comments before we wrap up. So NWR Neil posts, that's Neil Ronahan, of course, posted, first off, he shudders at Kid Ying and Dr. Yang, or whatever stupid names these characters have in the translation. It's Goemon and Abyssamaru for me. And for Greg,
what exactly about Abyssamaru makes him look like a doctor?
I don't know. He looks like a hobo to me, but...
Yeah, really.
Anyway, Neil also writes, I really dug this game when I played it a number of years ago. I played co-op with my friend through most of the game, and I believe you can grief each other really well, which led us to a point where only one person had any lives left. You can ride piggyback, and I'm pretty sure you can Yoshi jump to an all-new degree. Instead of an NPC dinosaur, you can send your friend to their doom. It sounds like none of us actually played this co-op, but you can tell throughout the game there's a number of places where you can actually play all the mini games co-op, and the action levels would be very interesting, because in a sense, they could actually be harder with two people, but there are certain things that might be easier.
There's a part towards the end where, like, you fight a mini-boss, and then you've got, like, this minecart ride, and you have it to jump over certain obstacles, duck under other ones. It's like, you know, with two people, there's not that much room on the cart. You know, how would this go down? Like, it does seem like it could be tricky. But, I mean, the town sections would surely benefit, because any of those brawler-type things...
the human wave.
They're way more fun when you've got another person to do it with, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Any co-op game can turn into a griefing session if you know what you're doing.
Yeah, but this one seems particularly suited to it. It's just... It has enough gameplay flaws that it could just go down.
Especially if person B has no idea what the hell's going on.
One nice thing about the two-player mode is that Abyssamaru is actually a distinct character. I mean, of course he looks different, but he has a different weapon that behaves somewhat differently than Goemon's weapon. And all of his magic powers are different. So they actually have different effects. And they look different too, but like, I think instead of riding a tiger, he rides a cow, which would be awesome.
That's one of those cultural anachronism things, because there are mythological characters who are somewhat comedic who ride cows.
Okay. Yeah, and that magic power is not that useful, actually, although the tiger's really cute. He looks like a stuffed animal when you ride on him, but he's it's not that useful. You have to jump, and if you hit something at the right point in your jump, it will hurt the enemy, but it's very hard to do it without hurting the tiger also. But, I mean, the magic powers are cool. Like, one of them's a lightning spell, which that's very useful.
That's the Mega Crush type thing.
Yeah, and then the third one is at least Goemon, I'm not sure what Abyssamaru does, but Goemon puts on a cape and you can just fly around freely. So you can use it to get over very difficult platforming sections or get up to a secret item that's otherwise you could probably only get with two player with a boost jump. So there's some really cool stuff in there, and you have to respect that the game, it seems like the kind of game that would be hard to design for two people. You know, I mean, it's in that Mario kind of vein, in that it's not something you can just slap on a cooperative mode. It was made that way from the beginning.
Again, I think that goes back to those Famicom games again.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess they kind of felt obliged to do it for this, even though it was significantly more complicated to do it. So it's nice that they followed through on that.
Right. And that came back in the second N64 game, Goemon's Great Adventure, which did come out in America, although it was kind of hard to find. And that game was entirely side-scrolling. And it looks nice. It's actually a very good game. The problem is, if you're not playing it two-player, it's almost impossible. I rented it once and played it by myself.
It falls into beating the original Crystal Chronicles game by yourself. You can do it.
Right.
But nobody at the company who made it probably could.
What I like about it is that the variety of kind of the level designs, and they seem to sort of increase in intricacy as it goes on. Like, you've got parts where you're kind of moving in and out of the background, where you're rotating an entire level. You have some real like Castlevania type stuff with like spikes and clockwork mechanisms and all this kind of stuff. There's just one level in the middle though that seems really phoned in. There's like this water level, and the town itself just wraps around. It's just a straight line. And then the level itself is just this curiously basic water level in the middle. It was really, that was really weird. Like, there seems to be a pretty smooth progression of difficulty and sort of different little wrinkles that each level introduces.
Did this also remind you of Dynamite Heady a little bit?
Oh, yeah. The wackiness and the kind of shifts definitely reminds
me of
that.
Just like random gameplay elements that are used once and then thrown away.
And then this water level just comes along. It was good. That was odd. But, I mean, in general, I think the level design of the side-scrolly stuff is really, you know, what makes it worth playing.
Right. That's the meat of the game. That's the interesting part. All right. Well, the final forum comment is from The Fleece, who posted, "I haven't played too many of these mini-games, but I did stop for a round of Gradius. The music is hilariously chipper, even when you're in constant doom while in town. I like the side-scrolling levels. The controls feel like Ghosts and Goblins." I don't know if I agree with that. "I attempted to play this game around 2005 and didn't get anywhere, but I'm glad I finally did because I'm enjoying it a lot." So, good to end on a positive note there. I'm glad you liked it, The Fleece. I hope, I hope everyone who played it because of us found something to appreciate out of it. It sounds like we might not have hit that mark with James. John, I know you didn't get that far, but I hope you'll, you know, pick it up again sometime. And
yeah, I mean, I thought it was okay. I thought it was a little bit punishing and kind of...
Yeah, I mean, that's where I'm at. I like...
It was really thin on gameplay for me. It was just... It's a very simple game. It's actually it's simpler than I remember.
The real problem is that your tolerance level for the kind of padding that you've got in this game today is much lower than it would have been back then.
And that's the thing. And I actually, you know, think of it fondly, and really playing it again now, I realize that it's actually not as good as I thought it was. Like, I really remember it as, oh, wow, I remember that was like kind of like an obscure, really cool game that I really liked. But now when I play it, it's like with so much time and so many games in the interim, and just seeing how far game design has come since games like that came out.
For me, it's just like the biggest problem I had was just that I just wanted to get on with the game.
Right.
Exactly.
You know, and it felt like it was resisting me a bit. And, you know, there's plenty of modern games that fall into that kind of category, but they serve you in different ways, you know, because they have like big narratives and big worlds and all this other kind of stuff.
That.
Whereas, you know, this is old school action, but they're just kind of giving it to you piecemeal.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the old days, there might have been upsides to that, because it just might have lasted you longer and you only got a game every so many months or whatever, you know, and you paid all this money for it. And, you know, but as an $8 digital download, you want to get on with it.
Yep.
Right. I mean, like, especially the first few levels, they're like 90% padding. Yeah. I mean, it was hard to get through them because I'm like, this is insufferable.
Well, you say 90% padding, but that's kind of because of the way you play it. Like, say, in the first town, you could get to the action part of that in probably 3 minutes.
Yeah, but the action part of that itself isn't very long either, though.
No, but then you move on to the next one.
The next one is all town, basically.
Yeah.
But again, that just means you can go through it and not even play it. And then you're on the third part that's more...
It kind of hits its stride after that for a while, I'd say, and then gets a bit bogged down towards the end.
Yeah, I would just like to have had more of the side-scrolling parts and less of the top-down.
Yeah, and that is what... I mean, the second game that's on... You know, obviously, I've played on the Japan Virtual Console. You get that. And, you know, I mean, also, you know, with the town bits, they're almost like a kind of a setup.
Right.
You can either choose to go straight through it, and then you can play the normal levels, and, you know, you've got no advantages. Mm-hmm. Or you can kind of grind away, give yourself every advantage, and make that level as easy as possible. They kind of distill this down in the second Gomon game with the giant robot boss fights, because before you actually have the boss fight, you just have a level where you're running through a town, destroying it. Right? And, and the more you destroy it, the more advantages you have in the boss battle. Like, the impact robot runs on coins, and the more you destroy, the more coins you have, and I think you get pipe bombs as well, which kind of helps. So it's basically like this game distilled into a few seconds of joyous destruction instead of minutes on end of just bopping people with a pipe. I'm not sure whether it was meant to be parodying itself quite that much.
It's quite possible, actually. So that's going to wrap up Retroactive and indeed the bulk of our episode. So thanks to everybody who posted in the forum, who played along. And, you know, I obviously we're a bit mixed on the game, but I do think it's very interesting. And if you do end up playing it, I hope you'll enjoy it. And I hope at the very least our discussion was interesting for everybody. And in terms of the next retroactive, it's not going to start up right away, but probably pretty soon we're going to have a poll up for everybody. And I'm kind of thinking, I like Greg's suggestion for the theme of this one that could be games that have recently been remade for a different platform. The nice thing about that is that we could kind of go outside of Virtual Console, because these are games that might be, you could play it on an older platform or you could play it on a newer platform, so you have either option there. So it's available in a lot of different ways, even if it's not something that has been on Virtual Console.
I was going to say, with some of those games, though, they're remade in such a way that they're not broken anymore, so.
Well, yeah, I mean, there may be some differences, but that's part of the fun, right? That's part of the theme. So anyway, we're working on the list for that, and we'll have it fairly soon, so stay tuned. We didn't have time for listener mail this episode, but we do have a couple that will carry over to next week, along with anything new that we get, and we would love to hear from you. The email address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Send in your questions about the Wii successor and the release list and Legend of the Mystical Ninja and all this other stuff, whatever new games you've been playing. We'll even talk more about Wii Play Motion if you want us to. Just send those emails in, rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. You can rate and review us on iTunes. We would very much appreciate that. You can like us on facebook.com/radiofreenintendo. You can follow me on Twitter @JohnnyMetz. You can also check out the latest episode of the newscast. It goes up on the weekends. We don't know yet what's on it, but you can probably guess based on some of the stuff we talked about earlier. There's also, by the time this goes up, there should be a brand new episode of Box Office Poison over at Crosstalk. Of course, that's me and a few other ex-RFN guys. This one has Stan Ferguson and Mike Sklenz on it because Carl was sick. But that's a fun show. We talk about movies and movie things. A lot of new movies that I saw in the theater discussed on that show. And we talk about Miller's Crossing, the old Coen Brothers movie. That is awesome. So you should check that out. I think that's all. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Later.
Oh, dude, that battle, the music in that battle is my favorite video game song ever.
The whole,
anything.
What the, you mean like the, through that whole area
dun,
where?
Dun, 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 dun.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I mean, that awesome. The music through that entire area is really creepy, where it has like the laugh in the background constantly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just like, okay. Yeah, really, really creepy music. But yeah, pretty much I rolled in there with, of course, Chrono.
Swallow, John. Swallow.
hold on.
That's what she said. Wait.
No. Try again.
I wonder what's going on there. What kind of role play?
I wonder if Duke Nukem Forever press releases are written from the perspective of Duke Nukem.
Yes, they are.
Did they have email in the mid-90s?
Yes. Technically, yes.
They did have email. I had an email address in the mid-90s.
So did I, but I'm just wondering whether Duke knows how to use email. He's so dated.
He's so badass, he would never actually use email. He would just, like, do something with his fist and whatever. Do something. Something would happen electronically.
He would punch the email into the computer.
Yep.
The correct response here is machete, don't text.
Yes, that's right. It'd be more like something like, you've got mail, and some kind of violence after that.
You've got mail. Blow it out your ass.